Good morning, everyone. I'd like to call the Senate Interim Committee on Healthcare, Human Services, and Rural Health Policy to order. Today is Wednesday, January 18th. Oh, my sister's birthday. I'm glad I said that. I'll email her. We have a very full agenda, and I felt it was extremely important to go through, have a little bit of dialogue on the LCs. I think that they all are going to be introduced. The reason it says work session just on the first ones is that those are the committee bills. The others are just public hearing because those are member bills. So that clarifies that. We're not preferencing any of them. With that, thank you, Senator Morris and Senator Cruz, for being here. And I know that Senator Shields and Senator Bates are in the building, but they're not here. So if you're out there, please get here. All right. Okay. Also, we have, and I'm remind me to do this at the end, too, with Bates and Shields. Because transformation is huge and it's going to start in the Senate, we are dedicating 2 hours on Friday starting at 1:15, and it'll go to 3:15. And so the House is hearing a portion of transformation now, but our agenda was so full, that's why we split it off, and we will have a full 2 hours to vet concerns. So with that, I would like to open a public hearing, and I'll just do work session later. Yeah.
Yeah.
Public hearing on LC 173 relating to influenza vaccinations, and would Jack Dempsey please come forward?
Thank you. Good morning. Jack Dempsey with the Oregon Nurses Association. Thank you for hearing LC 173. I will be brief. I know you have a lot today. So LC 173, what that does is tries to increase vaccination rates of seasonal influenza for all healthcare workers in all healthcare facilities in the state. ONA believes that all healthcare workers should be vaccinated for seasonal flu, and we think this is the best approach to get us there. What it does is it takes what we've seen work in some facilities in Oregon, which is a mandatory declination form, and it runs that form statewide. Facilities that have used a declination form coupled with a good education program, access to vaccines, have been able to get their vaccination rates up to, say, 85-90%. If we're able to do that statewide with all healthcare facilities, I will say we've won at that point. We have herd immunity. I don't think we need to do more. In addition, LC 173 also prevents some of the scarlet letter and shame approaches we've seen at a couple facilities that, in what we've seen, has unfairly targeted nurses and other non-physician providers and makes a person's vaccination status and why they've declined a private health record. Additionally, it requires facilities to report the de-identified data back to the Oregon Health Authority. Doing that, we will collect data on vaccinations rates generally, but also why people have declined, what groups of people, what professions, and why. And we would get some amazing data that'll show kind of what we need to do, what our next steps are, what is the education campaign we need to run to educate that last 10-15% of folks. And we'll know where to target our efforts at that point. That's basically it. We see this as an approach that's going to raise rates. The other approach that you might hear from a group that I think is going to be opposing this is we currently have an exemption on the books that prevents employers from making this a condition of employment. And I know there's folks that would like to go forward and just take that off the books and allow facilities to make this a condition of employment. And I think what I can argue there is that by doing that, you empower some facilities that, in our opinion, haven't shown that they can implement this policy fairly to continue doing that. And then the majority of healthcare facilities in the state that don't have an education campaign or use a declination form or anything, you allow them to continue to do nothing. Whereas our approach, I think, brings them to the table and tries to get the rates up in a, what I will say, a friendlier approach.
I think the information I need to have is, because that is the one Well, just for the history to the committee, Senator Morse started this.
Morissette.
Morissette, I meant, that's what I meant, Morissette.
They're different people.
Four years ago, I mean, before he left the legislature, and there has been a group working on this, and it was like there was always impasses. I mean, and so ONA has come forward with this. And the one thing that I hear from parties is this putting into statute, since I've been told that it's already in statute, that it cannot be a condition of work because it's stated somewhere else. Can you sort of clarify that again? I know you said
that is true, and we've been having conversations with Mel Cohn and the Public Health Agency to try to get their suggestions and figure out how we can amend this to get them in a positive place. And we incorporated some of their changes that we had early on, and I think they're going to have other changes based on that. And if one of them is to remove that language, which is stated twice, you are correct. I think we would be open to that.
Are there comments from the committee?
Yeah.
Yes.
I would.
Senator Cruz.
I know there's been a move to make that, to remove that section of statute. I think this is an appropriate step, and I would hope that we do this and see what the impact is. If we can get voluntary compliance, it's certainly a whole lot better than mandating it. So I like the bill as it is. I would be reluctant to see additional changes.
And just in response to that, if there is some controversy, the bill's probably not going to move. And that's my concern. We only have I'm not worried about the Senate so much as I'm worried about what will happen to it when it gets over the House. So I think that if we can get more people on board, and this is for all of these LCs, before the February session, in my mind, that makes much better sense, because I'm not going to waste time with a lot of amendments during February and the demand for various fiscals on every amendment. I mean, we just can't do that. And so I would advise you to, consider if you can bring anyone else on board with a change or two and still have a really good bill. That's my suggestion. Anyone else? All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
With that, I'll close the informational hearing on LC 173, and I'm going to open an LC on LC 174, and I think John Powell.
Right.
And Tom Holt.
Tom's not here.
Anthony Behrens.
Oh, this problem again.
Morning.
Good morning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is John Powell, representing Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Before you, in support of LC 174. Madam Chair, LC 174 is some technical changes to Senate Bill 89 from last session, and that was a rather large bill that dealt with several issues, including compliance with the new federal law and so many, many changes. One of the things that Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon placed in Senate Bill 89 was a fix to the issue that affected Representative Clem's mother-in-law. As you'll recall, there was a notice was not sent due to a death, or what Regents thought was a death, and the policy was no longer in force or canceled on that basis. In Senate Bill 189, we made sure that those notices would be sent. And in this draft, what was not taken into consideration was non-payment of premium. And so right now, we have to send two notices in the case of non-payment of premium, one under Senate Bill 89 and one under another statute that requires us to send those notices. So one of the changes that LC 174 takes care of is to make sure that we do not have to send duplicate notices in cases of non-payment of premium, because there is a statute that requires us to notify people in that case and give them a grace period and that sort of thing. So that's one of the changes that you'll see in the bill. And also, the bill's 21 pages long, but there are very few changes and nothing that of real substance. We've worked with the insurance division and other parties, including Representative Clem, who approves the changes that we're making in this bill. So you'll see on the top of page 3 an exemption to a duplicate notice to a cancellation due to non-payment of premium. On page 4, this is changing language from enrollees to certificate holders, and we will be requesting one amendment to that section in February, because it takes out the average of 20 employees for this particular section, and we think that needs to be in the bill. We'll be requesting that amendment. I think that was just an oversight. And the next change is on page 7, where we're just clarifying the fact that the director of DCBS will make rules that deal with continuation of coverage, as opposed to the items specified in the bill. And again, the insurance division is okay with that change as well. On page 11, on line 28, this is the section in the federal law that says that insurers cannot have lifetime limits on health insurance policies. And it was an oversight in that it just said you can't have a lifetime limit, but you potentially could have an annual limit. And this says, no, you can't have annual limits or lifetime limits. And again, it's simply a clarification of the law. The changes that Anthony and I could not figure out are in the last page of the bill, and we believe it's simply legislative council language on where these statutes are to be placed in the law in terms of location.
And why did you choose this particular location?
We didn't. This is not our language. This, I think, came from Legislative Council.
You'll clarify that. Okay, just will you be able to clarify that?
Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee, this language on page 21 is not our language either. And my understanding, and I'm not obviously an attorney for Legislative Council, is that this is, as Mr. Powell said, that this is placement. I can seek to clarify it from Legislative Council. And
we just are making a call to Lori, okay. If she could come.
I apologize.
Okay.
No and Madam Chair, but for the if not today, by the February session, we will have that clarified.
Yeah, absolutely.
You, so. Okay. All right. You didn't, on page 12, that's just, can you explain the change there in 13?
From a request submitted by an enrollee to a communication from an enrollee, again, I think this is clarifying and using language from the federal law, but I'm not sure. There's no substantive changes
okay.
there.
Chair Moss Anderson, members of the committee, I can address that if you would like. My understanding is that this particular change would allow an insurer to treat a complaint from an enrollee about an appealable matter as an appeal, even if the enrollee didn't specifically ask for an appeal. So from the division's perspective, the department's perspective, and for the record, my name is Anthony Behrens. I'm with the, if I didn't say it already, Department of Consumer Business mm-hmm. Services. From our perspective, that is more would be a more protective element, because it would help to ensure the enrollee got an appeal and there wasn't any confusion. And for whatever reason, if the enrollee just wanted to complain and they got an appeal, they could simply let the insurer know, hey, I don't want the appeal. But I think that's an unlikely scenario. So.
Well, Madam Chair, so basically what this does, request submitted, that's a specific form, and a communication is any communication, so it's actually broader. From the consumer perspective, and so they don't have to look at the hoops they might have to jump through.
Chair Monson-Anderson, Senator Cruz, I believe that's a fair way to explain it.
Lori Freeman. Oh, yes, Senator Shields. Come on up, Lori. Go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Bring another chair up.
Anthony or John, going to the issue of cancellation for non-payment, if you can help me refresh my memory on the facts of Brian Clem's mother-in-law's case, wasn't the issue that the insurance division couldn't intervene in that situation because Regents made the case that they stopped making payment because the electronic funds transfer was stopped, even though they didn't authorize the stoppage of the electronic funds transfer. But what you're saying is it's already required in statute that for non-payment to get a notice. But I think Clem contested that they never received any notice, right? And the insurance division said that there wasn't anything to do because this was a contractual issue. Is that your understanding?
Chair Monson-Anderson, Senator Shields, there were a number of issues, I guess, unfortunate circumstances that just compiled to create the mess that befell Representative Clem's mother-in-law, and it was, and unfortunately, my recollection of the specificities, the legal specifics of that issue are not fresh in my mind. I think what the issue is here is that there is a process in place for cancellations and for non-payment of premiums, and it's from my brief discussions with Representative Clem, it was my understanding that his bill was to address something else, something not related to cancellation for non-payment of premiums. He wanted he wanted to address the issue regarding other types of terminations, and I know Ms. Freeman was involved a little bit on this, and maybe she recalls some of the legal issues involved. But we had, as part of Senate Bill 89, some rulemaking hearings, and we did have some consumer input. And although this particular section requires a couple of different notices, the consumers seemed in favor of more notice. They thought additional notice was a good thing, and that perhaps the two notices in this case would be important. So I just wanted to let the committee know that.
Senator Bates?
I'm going to follow up this, too. When I saw two cancellations due to non-payment premium, it always raises a really difficult issue here. It's not just what happened to Representative Clem's grandmother. So this cancellation due to non-payment premium gets very complicated very quickly. Commonly, a provider will provide a service. They check the insurance company that individual is covered, and then they find out months later that, in fact, there was a cancellation because somebody didn't pay a premium. Quite often, it's a child or a spouse, and there's a divorce involved, and the person who's supposed to be paying the payment didn't, and the person who's supposed to be insured isn't but doesn't know it, and there's a lapse time in there. So whenever I see this phrase, I kind of go, well, let's think about all the ramifications of this phrase before we start talking about it too much. And so I'm not going to say I'm going to oppose the bill. I'm just going to say that this morning we're not going to resolve this particular issue, but it's a good time to start thinking about it. We've only got 4 weeks to look at this bill. And this one little phrase might have ramifications that we just might want to think a little bit about before we go too far down this road and have an opportunity to really discuss it with both providers and insurers and making sure the information flow is clear amongst all these people, because it gets pretty murky out there in the real world sometimes. And then you really get into it. I mean, you can really get into it really fast.
Madam Chair, again, John Powell for Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield of Oregon. Again, the provision in this bill does not remove, obviously, the required notice for non-payment of premium. It simply says that you won't have to do two notices to the same party, which could cause confusion. If indeed the reason for cancellation is non-payment of premium, that's what they should be told. That's the notice they should be receiving. If in that statute, if we don't give that notice, coverage continues. So, again, this is simply streamlining the act. It does not deal with the issues, unfortunately, that people can get into based on non-payment of premium. It doesn't deal with it one way or the other, but it definitely does not remove the insurer's obligation to make that notification.
Chair, can I ask one follow-up question? So, John, you might not know the answer off the top of your head, but so my understanding in Representative Clem's mother-in-law's case, they contended that that nobody called Regents to say the mother-in-law had passed away. Regents said somehow they got this word. Is Regents contending that they did send notice to Representative Clem or whoever the party is saying we're canceling your policy for non-payment? Could you check into that to see if Regents contended they did send that notice?
Madam Chair and Senator Shields, I can check into that.
Okay. Because my understanding was that for some reason the electronic funds transfer stopped. They didn't know that it stopped, never received notice. And then when they got sick and had this, or the accident, had a very big bill, it was denied based on the basis that they were no longer insured because they didn't, the electronic funds transfers had been stopped from their account. So if a letter was sent to them and both parties concede that would be a good fact for us to have.
And Madam Chair, again, my recollection is, and I suffer from the Barron's disease of not having things on the tip of my brain, is that a notice was not sent because of they thought it was due to a death. And and that's what this bill, that's the hole we plugged in Senate Bill 89, was that a notice would be sent in that case. Death notices are controversial. For example, I received one day in the mail the clipping from a manila envelope showing a postage charge that was sent to the widow of a member of the legislature, and they thought it was a very much of a waste that Regents Blue Cross Blue Shield had sent a notice saying that their spouse was no longer covered.
After the
and so that was when Regents administered the PEB program. And so it has been controversial in the past in terms of sending those notices.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you have been working with DCBS, and at this point, except for a concern of where this is being put in statute, Lori Freeman, could you introduce yourself and explain why it's going where it is?
Yeah, Lori Freeman, Legislative Counsel, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I think you're talking about section 20 or page 21.
Yes.
Section 9. And what this does is it unadds 743.822 and 743.826 from the series 743.730 to 743.773. And at the risk of putting everyone to sleep, that series, that 743.730 to 743.773, is a very popular series because it has a definition section in 743.730 that applies to the series. And so in drafting, we tend to want to add things to that series so that we don't have to redefine everything. We just pick up all the definitions from 743-730. Unfortunately, during the last compilation process, we ran out of numbers in that series. And so, and so those two particular statutes, they only picked up one definition from 743-730, so we thought, well, if we're only picking up definitions, which is all we were doing in those sections, instead of adding them to the series, we'll just say, as defined in 743-730. And so we're trying to figure out what we're going to do next time, next time around. We even had to put two different statutes together, or two sections of one bill together in one statute to try to squeeze them into that series. So just technical change.
And Madam Chair, my previous testimony stands.
Yeah, interpretation may be...
I still don't understand.
Difficult. At least now we understand why, and so at this point, it's going to stay where it is, it sounds like.
Thank you very much.
Okay, all right, thank you very much.
Madam Chair, we're running out of numbers. It's at some point in time we need to do some massive cleanup of the ORS.
Oh, no, God. All right, with that, I'll close the public hearing on LC 174 and open a public hearing on LC 180 relating to civil commitment Native Americans. And we have Michael Mason from the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Moniz Anderson, members of the Senate Health Care Committee, for being so amenable to working on this issue. And I am a little concerned, though, because I just learned that looking over the ORS, the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon has four different names in the ORS. So, but we haven't decided to address that in this bill, so we're not going to go back through all the statutes.
Haven't ran out of numbers yet.
That's right. So my name is Michael Mason. I'm lobbyist for the Confederated Tribes of the Warm Springs Reservation of Oregon, commonly referred to as the Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs or Confederated Tribes of Warm Springs Reservation, but or the Warm Springs Tribes. So LC 180, though it looks a little complicated, is really quite simple. And I'm a little embarrassed for not noticing this a few years back, but as time has gone on, we've gotten to a point where civil commitment is not just to Damish, which of course doesn't exist anymore, or to the state hospital. It's to a facility approved by, or hospital approved by OHA. And so we've been working with the Oregon Health Authority to revise a bill from the 1950s. Just a brief background, Public Law 280, a federal law in 1953, extended state jurisdiction over all of the reservations except Warm Springs in the state. So after Warm Springs was specifically accepted by Congress, the legislature dealt with that and said, okay, we need a process if there's a person who's a danger to themselves or others from Warm Springs to get them into the proper facility. So the antiquated statute that is being corrected here, or updated, I should say here, talks about the ruling body of the reservation, talks about land-based tribes. And, of course, all the tribes have land now after the restorations. But basically, this is just catching or getting to the point where Warm Springs members are not treated disparately from everyone else in the state who now have the flexibility to be placed in different facilities if they're in need of a civil commitment. So I'm happy to answer questions about it, and I appreciate the work of the committee and Legislative Council on this.
I think as you explained to me, so if someone needs to be civilly committed into a mental hospital that lives in Burns, right now under statute, they would have to be committed to the state hospital in Salem. With this statute, if we pass this statute, they could look for beds, say, at St. Charles in Bend.
Chair Moniz Anderson, members of the committee, that's absolutely correct. That's the whole point of the statute, of this bill.
Questions?
This is, in my mind, this is reasonable, appropriate, and a technical fix.
Thank you. Sorry.
Hopefully we'll pass it on the first day.
Madam Chair.
Lovely.
remind me to grab you out in the hall. I think you got a typo in here that needs to be fixed. I'll talk to you about it in private. Left the word
another,
not.
Another way
no,
of stating.
Left the word not out in an important place, and I'll talk to you
okay,
about it.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Senator Baker.
Thanks. This is a typo, but you got to fix it.
Okay.
Okay. No other questions? We're moving along. All right. Thank you. I'll close the public hearing on LC 180. And are we going to 181 next?
It's not dangerous to others.
Yes. Okay. We'll open a public hearing on LC 181 relating to mental health drugs. And I'd like to call Josh Bishop from Pacific Source, Chris Bonif from NAMI, and Robin Henderson from St. Charles. And then.
And Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I do have in with your materials written testimony, and I want to acknowledge it from, for the record, from Jim Gardner representing Pharma. It is a one page after the LC in your packet. So please. Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Dr. Robin Henderson. I'm with St. Charles Health System. I'm the Director of Behavioral Health. I'm also the Acting Director of the Central Oregon Health Council. I'm here to speak to you today in support of LC 181, and I'm speaking on behalf of the entire Central Oregon Health Council. As you may recall, I believe it was out of this committee, we created Senate Bill 204 that chartered the Central Oregon Health Council, which is comprised of county commissioners, the CEO of the health system, St. Charles, the CEO of the Medicaid payer in the region, Pacific Source Health Plans, and we've added since the time of conception three additional members, the president of the Central Oregon Independent Practice Association, Dr. Stephen Mann, and then two consumer representatives, one representing the Medicaid population, one representing the Medicare population. That's the basic history of the Health Council. We've been together now in whatever iteration for nearly 3 years. And as you will recall, we're the successful pilot demonstration project looking at high utilization amongst emergency departments. I think we testified before this committee in the last session about our efforts. That diversion project alone, in our first initial 6 months, looked at 144 unique individuals who had 13 or more visits to the emergency department within a year's period, and reduce costs for the hospital in terms of cost avoidance, nearly 66%, in terms of cost avoidance to the health plan, nearly 77%, based upon performance from the prior year. Part of the cornerstone of that project is what we call a health engagement team. And a health engagement team involves a physician and a nurse case coordinator and a behavioral health consultant and a community health worker. And one of the things that we've learned from this project and the broader applicability is we missed an opportunity, and that opportunity was related to pharmacy. One of the things that we learned in this project was we have a blind spot with mental health. Initially, early on, that blind spot was relegated primarily to their mental health visits. We took care of that in January of 2011 when Pacific Source Health Plans combined with, or not really combined, but subsumed the mental health capitation, and we could see all of the visits for mental health, so you could actually get that complete picture of the patient. But as time went on, we realized we couldn't see some of the medications, and these are the medications that are fairly key to the individuals that we're dealing with. They're called 7-Eleven drugs in our nomenclature, but they're primarily antipsychotics and antidepressants, high-risk, high-need psychotropic medications that, when applied, can have very good outcomes, but they can also have some very bad outcomes when they're not applied appropriately, and I'll defer to my learned colleague, Josh, to talk about that. We want to expand our health engagement teams in our community. The Health Council is heartened by the results we've gotten off the Emergency Diversion Project. We want to expand that to looking at early childhood, birth to, say, about 26 years old, looking at the early psychosis projects, complex care patients across the lifespan, folks with chronic diabetes who may be on multiple medications, and, of course, looking at long-term care and care transitions. These are some of the most expensive people in our health system. But in order to do that, we really need your help, because one of the opportunities we have for pilot expansion allows us to really have the robust ability to look at those medications in real time. Right now, as Josh will explain a little later, there are challenges to that. What we need is the ability in real time when that health engagement team is sitting together talking, often with the patient, to be able to see accurately and immediately what medications they are on. And we can't do that in our current system. I want to tell you that the Central Oregon Health Council fully endorses this concept. We're very much engaged with NAMI in the development of this concept, and we believe that we can be that pilot demonstration for you that shows how an entire community, including a health system, a payer, the public and private mental health system, the public health department, the mental health department, and all of the physicians within the community can work together to really contain and control healthcare costs, but more important than that, improve the health of the community that we live in and that we serve. This bill does not remove the carve-out for mental health drugs. All this bill does is change the payer, and that's what we're asking for from you today, is to hear that piece and that theme repeatedly as we talk. So I'm going to turn this over to my learned colleague, Josh Bishop, who will tell you more about the details.
Chair Mom Sanderson, members of the committee. I'm Josh Bishop. I'm a pharmacist. I'm also the director of pharmacy for Pacific Source Community Solutions. As Dr. Henderson alluded to, we've made a lot of progress in Central Oregon to integrate mental health and physical health. The one blind spot that we have is with the mental health drugs. As we sit around at our weekly dialogue with clinicians in the community, the behavioral health workers, in some cases the patients, we can now see the mental health visits those patients have. We can see the physical health claims. What we cannot see is the mental health drugs. That creates a problem. We know that these members, the Medicaid population specifically, highly utilize 7-Eleven or mental health medications. We know that those patients with comorbid chronic physical health conditions and mental health conditions cost on average 5 times more than their counterparts who have exclusively the physical health conditions and no mental health conditions. These are our complex patients, and we want to provide higher services, more wraparound services to these patients. At this point, we're having a hard time seeing that. About 3 months ago, we started getting some data. We get data feeds from the state that are about 6 weeks old. That's problematic because these patients need care today. We need to know if they're still taking their antidepressants or antipsychotics today, not 6 weeks ago. We've already hit the crisis mode if we're looking at the data 6 weeks, 6 weeks late. There is some speculation that the Oregon Health Authority would be able to provide data in a more timely basis. That is very contingent on MMIS system being able to provide that. I had the opportunity to speak with the pharmacy director of the Oregon Health Authority yesterday. There is no confirmation that, one, we're going to get the data or that it's going to be in a workable format. Very important to us is to be able to see those claims within our existing data sets. It's one thing, and it's partially successful, if we can see the data and start making informed decisions around adherence or outbound calls from members or physicians to improve adherence for these medications. It's another thing, and I think where we really need to be is to have a comprehensive data set where we can run our clinical algorithms and say, here's a patient with diabetes and comorbid schizophrenia. Let's reach out to them proactively and make sure that we're doing the right thing ahead of time, not being reactive to the acute crisis or the psychosis.
Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, I'm Chris Bonaf. I'm the executive director of NAMI Oregon, the National Alliance on Mental Illness of Oregon. We're the state chapter of the national organization. I just wanted to talk about a couple pieces in here that really we're very enthusiastic about. This came about in that the folks in Central Oregon who we've worked with very closely on their integration efforts and their pilots wanted to try to improve prescribing practices for mental health medications, and that's something that we have advocated for a number of years now. Typically, the answer to cost issue around medications is to just put on a blanket denial on access to particular medications. And nowhere in that conversation have we ever addressed the quality side of things. How do we get people who are on significant medications such as antipsychotics and antidepressants, how do we get to the prescriber level and consumer level and really work with them on the appropriate use of medications, the appropriate review of medications, so we can improve health outcomes? particularly with these medications, the side effects can be so tremendous that we end up often with polypharmacy rather than revisiting medications. We end up with people not taking their medications. We end up with prescribers prescribing serious antipsychotics without really the knowledge base that they need to work individually with a patient in his or her best interest. So this is an issue that we've long wanted to address and haven't had a willing partner until Central Oregon approached us with this concept. We worked in partnership with them for about 2 months to craft a concept that you see the before you today. That I have to amend my written testimony in the sense that a new draft of this came out last night and that addresses some of the original concerns that we had with the original draft. So I'm able to say that we favor this current draft of LC 181. Key provisions is that this does protect access. Traditional utilization techniques are not allowed by this. This specifically says here are the four techniques you may use, and one of them is not denying access. It's a great concern to us, any technique that would turn someone away at the point of sale, which is a traditional utilization technique, a prior authorization, those type of things. And I can tell you from personal experience, when you're in the middle of a crisis and your physician gives you a prescription and you go to the pharmacy and they tell you, no, can't have it, you got to go back, or we got to work it, you don't come back to the pharmacy. You go to the hospital eventually, or you end up in jail. Because when you're in the middle of a mental health crisis or your judgment is impaired because of your illness, what would seem like a routine transaction, I'll go back to my physician, somebody has to send the paperwork, that turns into an insurmountable barrier. And because of that, lives, your condition worsens, the cost of treating that condition escalates. And so what we like about this is everything that is going to be done in this pilot preserves access. It preserves that relationship between prescriber and family and individual to try to find the right medication and, frankly, the right treatments that support that medication to help someone improve and stabilize. Another key provision that we really like about this is creating the mental health clinical advisory group. So again, in our system, in our non-integrated system that we currently have, even though we're moving towards integration, you go to see a physician, you go to see a psychiatrist, a nurse practitioner, and they prescribe you a medication, and then you may or may not have a mental health practitioner, and they may or may not, most likely may not talk, and they never see you as a whole person, and they never put together all the treatments that are necessary for someone to improve. So let's take depression for an example. You may go see your primary care physician. I'm depressed. They'll give you an antidepressant, and it's come back in 8 weeks, and let's see how it's going. What this clinical advisory group is about is creating what we call treatment algorithms. So there are medication algorithms. If you have this, use this medication. If you have this metabolic problem, then go to this medication. What this is good is we're going to look at the system as a whole so that it's not just medication related. It's really what are the treatments and supports. If I come in with depression and it's mild depression, maybe actually an antidepressant is not the best thing. Maybe it's these other techniques, diet, exercise, all these other things that we know are very effective for mild depression, but they often don't get implemented because it's much easier sometimes to give a prescription and let someone go on their merry way. Same thing with early psychosis. And we have in this state a very good early intervention program for early psychosis for kids and young adults. It follows a particular algorithm. If we can get that type of education in the hands of more practitioners, that, okay, if someone shows up into my clinic with these type of symptoms, not only is this a medication or a class of medications I can consider, but now I need to start down a referral process so we can do the behavioral interventions or wraparound services that we know are very effective, we're going to have much more positive outcomes. And I think consequently what we're going to see is as we continue to talk about triple aim and integration, because our outcomes improve, our episodes of mental illness, the duration will decrease and we'll see improvement in cost and we'll actually see some savings to the system. And it's our hope that, again, through the techniques described in LC 181, we're fairly confident we will see positive results in that direction. Thank you.
Chairman Anderson, members of the committee, I would just add to the cost equation, I think, as we've looked at, we've received about 3 months of data to date from the Oregon Health Authority. This is an expensive group of medications, and I think that's why you haven't seen payers come up to the table and say, we'd like to take responsibility for this. For our population alone, just about 3,000 members are utilizing these medications, incurring about $450,000 a month. It ends up being about a third of our existing physical health pharmacy budget. So it's a very significant proposition to bring this into our capitation. However, I think it's short-sighted to think that the only cost savings would be by denying access to medications. The real cost in the system is when these patients don't take their medications like they're supposed to, and they end up having that acute crisis. And what we would like to do is proactively go after those patients who are on the medications and ensure that they're getting the medications that they need, that we're informing the patient and the prescriber relationship, so that one, that they stay on the medication, they get on the right medications, and our providers are well informed on taking care of these patients.
Question.
A quick comment, question. Thanks for your work. I know you're doing the right stuff, and it's always shocking to me that in an area like this, there's no algorithms there already, and that it's sort of a wild, wild west out there sometimes in prescribing this stuff, and the variations across the state is actually pretty shocking, and from prescriber to prescriber. So it's something that needs to be done. Unfortunately, it hasn't been already. One part of this bill concerns me, though, and I think we need to at least be aware of it. On page 4, section 11 here, you're basically saying that every 6 months you can review your claims, I think, and if it's and the claims are over 1% higher than what you're capitated for, you want the Oregon Health Authority to make up the difference. I think every CCO and every organization in the state would like to have that kind of a clause in their contracts, and it would break the system. It would break the system. I know this is a pilot, okay, and you want some leeway because it's a pilot. But I don't know of an MCO or MHO or DCO in this state that wouldn't say, hey, our claims this last 6 months are up, and we need a bump to cover that as long as, you know, if it's over the 1% mark. And so it's a situation we have to look at very carefully here before we pass this through, and I would guess it'll come to Ways and Means ultimately if that kind of a clause is in there.
Chair Monis Anderson, Senator Bates, I'm happy to speak to that. It is a pilot. It does sunset in 2 years. In no way is Pacific Source Community Solutions or Central Oregon Health Council looking for absolution of risk in this. It is an expensive proposition, and it's a unique perspective to come in and say we're not going to do any of our traditional utilization management, use those methods to control this cost. If anything, I would predict, as Chris Bonoff alluded to, cost savings in this. In no way is that guaranteed, and that's why we put that language in. However, I think most parties involved would say that either through direct cost savings, which would be more prescribing of generic medications and patient and physician education, or through better care management and avoidance of hospitalizations and emergency room visits, we will save the money for the system. And we are embarking on a memorandum of understanding with our Central Oregon partners to ensure that any cost savings that's generated from this program does go back into the community. I understand your concern. I do believe that if anything, we'll err on the side of cost savings, not greater cost for the system.
My reply to that is still I have some caution here. And the way I'm reading this is it's just, it says claim expenses exceed capitation payments. Are we talking about just claim expenses for the medications or about the entire organization? Because you could have tremendous savings in the organization as far as hospitalization is concerned, and as a net be in a good position, and yet be asking for compensation for the pharmaceuticals. So this needs to be clarified, I think thoughtfully so, and we'll have to see what this really looks like as far as cost is concerned. You may not have noticed, but we're in a little bit of a crunch financially in this state right now. We're looking at huge cuts to the Oregon Health Plan, and as much as I support this program, I think there is cost savings here. I think it would be better if we rewrote this in a way that says if there's savings in your system, we shouldn't be expecting more money for pharmaceutical benefit.
I think we'd be very open. Senator Monis Anderson, Senator Bates, I think we would be very open to those conversations.
Thank you.
Senator Morris.
Madam Chair, thank you. would refer to ORS 414-742, which is pointed out in Mr. Gardner's opposition letter. For the layperson here, could somebody explain the background why we prohibit capitation reimbursement versus a fee for and require a fee for service reimbursement? Is it a clinical patient safety issue, or is it a financial issue?
The financial issue.
Senator Morse, if I understand the question right, and I'm a lay person too, so I may not. The reason we do things the way we do in Oregon is a patient protection, so that the situation I described, and it actually does happen in our state even with this protection, and I've worked with families, but you get a prescription, you go to the pharmacy, and they will tell you no based on a preferred enforceable preferred drug list. Because psychotropic medications, the research, it's we're getting a greater body of research, but we really still don't understand how some of these medications work, why people with similar conditions, one person will respond to one medication and won't to the same medication, but will respond to a different medication within the same class. And because there's just not a wide body of these medications available, organizations like NAMI have worked very hard to protect that access to those medications. And I'll give you an example of the story as to why. And this was due really to an administrative snafu rather than something else. But we worked with a family now. I worked with this family about 2 years ago, where they went in to get a prescription, a young woman who was very stable on a particular medication for bipolar, went in after her year visit to renew her prescription. Well, the pharmacy billed the wrong entity, and so she was denied her medication, and 3 days later she was in the hospital. And it took probably about 2 or 3 months to stabilize her back so she could return to the community. And it's just use that as an example of why that protection is there, is to make sure that one, the relationship between prescriber and patient is protected so that they're able to look at all medications, not only expensive atypical antipsychotics, but even first-generation antipsychotics. You want a prescriber looking at the whole regimen that's out there. But then also when that person goes to fill that prescription, again, what can be a tremendous barrier for people living with mental illness, it removes that barrier, makes it easier to get your medication and continue taking your medication.
Yeah, if I could, and we've been going up and down this hill since I've been in the building, and quite honestly, the reason for the carve out for 7-Eleven was, as you spoke, we want to make sure that they're getting what they need, and we're not experimenting with them. If the physician feels this is the appropriate drug, that's where the experiment needs to take place, not the system itself. Now, when I'm reading this, what I'm saying is, and it's clearly a barrier right now, is having all the providers that are taking care of this patient know what everybody's doing. That's the issue, is to make sure that there's full communication so that the diabetic with mental health issues, all the providers in there know what the mix is. And quite honestly, from my personal perspective, 2 years ago when my mother went in the hospital, her primary care physician came in because she had all these doctors all over the place prescribing all these things. And he said, time out. Let's look at this whole mix. And they cut it in half. Okay. Everybody's doing really good things in their little universe. And what we're after here, I think, is that to expand the universe of people doing really good things. So, and Senator Bates is right about that section. I mean, that would allow game playing, and I think we need to be very careful about that.
Thank you.
Because you would be able to save maybe a lot by not having hospitalization, but you may increase the cost of the prescription drugs.
Chairman Sanderson, you're absolutely correct. We may. There's a lot of fluctuations when you start looking at care coordination projects. You may decrease hospitalizations and increase primary care, and that's okay. As long as we're increasing in the places that are appropriate and in the best interest of the patient's health outcomes, that's what's really the bottom line, because we look at cost savings in many different ways. One is the early cost savings we get by treating the current rampant polypharmacy and the issues that Senator Cruz alludes to. One of the things that we're looking at regionally is a product called VistaLogic. And VistaLogic is a care coordination system. It's an electronic system that operates almost kind of like a health information exchange, but it's looking at the social disparities of health. That has an application in it that we can feed pharmacy claims data into, and theoretically you could see it all there in one accessible record for everybody quickly in the community that kind of jumps the barrier between having all of our electronic health records mixed together. That's one solution that gets us early on cost savings if we can do this. But the true cost savings are 5 and 10 years down the road, when we're looking at having those appropriate medications at the right time, at the right place, with good adherence. Now, we're reducing the onset of chronic diabetes, the onset of the cholesterol issues, the onset of all of the side effects that come from the polypharmacy when it's not appropriately applied. When we looked at this initially and started working with NAMI, we brought in an expert, Dr. Danny Carlett, from Tufts University, who's an expert in psychotropic medications, author of the Carlett Report, which is the largest non-industry publication. And he started talking about some of the polypharmacy practices that happen within our community, primarily in primary care. And some of these medications that are used as adjunctive therapies to antidepressants, like a Seroquel or something like that, very, very, very expensive, and they're very expensive Benadryl. And as the good Dr. Bates knows, how much does a Benadryl cost? And how much does a dose of Seroquel cost? That type of education at the provider level, when we know that's going on, is where we're going to get initial cost savings. But the true cost savings are when that person doesn't develop diabetes. That's kind of what we're after. So it's really a very multi-layered issue.
Senator Bates.
I think we've covered this pretty well. We could be here all morning on this one. But what you said is correct. I mean, I think the medical profession, and I'll probably get hammered to walk out of the room for it, has been, especially in primary care, we've been a little casual about prescribing these very powerful drugs. And we have not been sensitive to cost at all times. But as you said, you never know why one individual in a group of people responds to one drug and not the other. And it may be an expensive one or it may be an inexpensive one. And we don't really know why that happens and doesn't happen. So taking these people off these drugs just because one's cheaper than the other is not the right thing to do. And developing a logical algorithm that we can look at and say, this is where we should go first, is the proper thing to do. And I would look forward to seeing that come out and making it simple and straightforward would be the right way to go. But to take people off a drug simply because one's less expensive is exactly what you're talking about. Yeah. We don't want to go there.
Yeah. Madam Chair,
that's not the intent.
But that's been the whole argument.
But that's what's happening.
Is we don't want to be driving care for people with mental health issues by dollars. It's by care. Yeah. And as long as we keep that focus.
I do want to point out, again, I talked to a couple of pharmaceutical representatives as well as this letter from Jim Gardner from the Oregon Council of Pharma. Have you seen a copy of that? No, so make sure that they do. It's important to talk to them because they state that they support continuation of the longstanding protections for mental health drugs and oppose any attempt to limit those protections. And they also, in this paragraph, state they encourage the proponents to work with the Oregon Health Authority to obtain the data necessary to optimize collaborative treatment. I think you've already addressed that piece, that you need real time, not 6-week time. Okay.
Thank you.
Great. But I do want you to have a copy of this and then contact.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee. I think real-time data is ideal. I also think there's a lot to be determined in the practicality of that data. A real-time database where we can call in and look at member-by-member claim information is one thing. But then again, like I alluded to, having that data married to our data sets and being able to cross-reference and do clinical algorithms to target complex care patients, that's another thing. And I very much question the practicality of an MMIS solution.
Great. Thank you. Thank you very much. And I see some pharmaceutical representatives in the back, and it's real important for you to, now you know the main players here, to talk with them regarding your concerns. Okay.
Do you want to go back to 173?
Yes. Okay, I'll close the public hearing on LC 181, and I want to reopen public hearing on LC 173 because the Hospital Association, Andy Easton, wanted to put some things on the record on the influenza vaccination, LC.
And then I need to dial in after.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Moses Anderson and members of the committee. I'm Andy Easton, the Director of Advocacy for the Oregon Hospital Association. And I'm sorry I wasn't able here to be here earlier this morning when you had the hearing first open. But on behalf of our 58 hospitals, we applaud ONA for coming forth with legislation to address flu vaccinations in our state. However, the association would like to see this language go further, and we'd like to see it be strengthened. And we all agree that flu vaccinations, the increase of flu vaccinations is a public health issue. We also believe that increasing our flu vaccinations increases our patient safety and reduces the rate of transmission from care workers to patients. Over the last couple of years, Oregon hospitals have made a big push to increase our rates within our hospitals. We have seen that jump from 62% in the 09 to 69% of flu vaccinations amongst our employees in the 10-11 years. We have done this through numerous campaigns, including informational campaigns, making vaccinations available for our employees as well as their families, and we have done internal kind of challenges among units. So we've put incentives in there for employees to be vaccinated as well. Again, we would like to see the language go further. We've had discussion amongst our public policy committee within the association to actually see about changing the current statute and removing the current statute that prohibits vaccinations to be a condition of employment. We would like to work with ONA and other providers, including public health, to strengthen the language and come back with a policy that we can all agree upon that really would increase and make a difference in our vaccination rates in this state. So again, I thank you for making the opportunity for letting us speak on behalf of this bill, and we will be working with our partners in making this language tighter.
Good. You had missed some of the testimony earlier talking about this very issue, and my concern is it's already in statute. Mm-hmm. Would you feel better if in this particular LC, if that piece on a condition of work be removed, would that make you a little bit feel any better?
Chair Moses Anderson, that would help. That would be a good starting point to have that piece removed in the current LC.
And it is in other statutes.
It is in other statutes. Our feeling is that if that piece is removed out of all current statutes, then that would make an agreement between the hospital and its providers. It could be a negotiation issue to find the right fit for what's best for that hospital. What's the right mix for having vaccinations for their employees? Who should be vaccinated and who should not? I mean, it allows to have that negotiation down at the hospital level between labor and management.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Very much.
Oh. Just a quick question.
Oh, sorry.
Has there been a discussion besides, and we were just talking about influenza here, it's been a discussion about pneumonia vaccine and other vaccines. I mean, I just got to tell you, when I talk to my infectious disease physicians, they think it's just outrageous that people in hospitals who are working in hospitals don't get vaccinated. They're dealing with patients who are immune suppressed, who are ill. We talk about patient protection here, and we're sort of pussyfooting around this thing. I know this is a step in the right direction. I really appreciate it, but I've been talking for years about why the world we allow this to go on. You're in your most vulnerable situation as a patient when you're in there for surgery or in there for treatment of a cancer and immune suppression. You're already ill with something else, and you may be dealing with an individual who's carrying a disease but hasn't got any symptoms yet, because mm-hmm. you got about 10 days before it shows up, and you're being exposed to somebody who has influenza and gives it to you, or has pneumonia and gives it to you, before they even know they have it themselves. The logic here escapes me, so I'm kind of going off here, but I think that the Hospital Association is really on the right track. I appreciate what the nurses are doing, trying to bring this along sequentially, step by step, moving up on it. But if you can strengthen this, I'm there for it. I just don't understand the logic of this. And so I appreciate you stepping up this morning and talking to us. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
With that, I'll close the public hearing on LC 173. And Sandy needs to call. Who are we calling?
Well, I'm just opening up the conference call line to get our next two presenters in.
Okay, I'm going to open a public hearing on LC 182 relating to HIV testing. And Christina.
AT&T teleconference service. Please enter your access code, followed by the pound sign.
Christina and Andrew.
Your access code was not recognized. Please re-enter your access code, followed by the pound sign. Your access code was not recognized. Please re-enter your access code, followed by the pound sign.
Okay. Well, let's try this number.
We're sorry. Your access...
All right. Sorry. My little code isn't working. Do you have phone numbers for them?
I believe I have...
Andrew Seaman and Michael Kaplan and Todd Corthius.
Let me send them a quick message to ask for their personal cell phones. I have their business
And then we can
phones.
Call them in. And then, okay. But you can start.
Sure.
Thanks.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Sorry about this.
Madam Chair, Senators of the Committee, my name is Dr. Andrew Seaman. I'm a third-year resident physician in Portland, Oregon. I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak in favor of LC 182. In it, we propose removing the requirement for a special, separate informed consent for HIV testing while maintaining an individual's right to know they'll be tested and decline if desired. So to give you a background as to why we're here today, during the course of my training, I've seen a string of patients come into our emergency department with severe end-stage complications of HIV without knowing they were infected. Of the many, I think one is very pertinent. There's a 32-year-old woman who has two elementary school-aged children and presented with a lung infection that you almost only get with severe end-stage AIDS. She had been in our ER seven times in the previous 5 years, two of which with actual symptoms of a sexually transmitted disease. Just based on the natural history of HIV, all likelihood is that she was infected all or at least most of those times previously. And though while she was sent for a chlamydia and gonorrhea test, an HIV test was not performed. And I guess the question is why not? In the immediate sense, if you ask some of the ER docs, they'll say, well, you know, there's just too much involved with testing. This is acute care. That's an outpatient issue. And they kind of push it off. It's turfing. It's like the bane of medicine. But looking into it further, it's more than that. You know, I found that almost 40% of patients in the state of Oregon with HIV present with late-stage findings. That's much worse than the national average. In 2006, that's despite the fact that in 2006, the CDC recommended that everyone between the ages of 13 and 64 gets one HIV test, and certain individuals get one yearly. However, in all my training, both here and elsewhere, this just doesn't happen, not in the ERs, not in the clinics, not in the hospitals. In fact, testing hasn't changed, rates haven't changed in a decade or more. So I thought that at this point we need to systemize it like any good prevention program. So I set us out to design a screening program in my own ER. What I found, though, was that tests were cheap. The staff was willing. But we did not have the resources to perform the special, separate, informed consent process, the same process that we require surgeons to do prior to taking a patient to the operating room is required for an HIV test. We would have had to hire extra people to do it, and my project has hit a wall and has stayed there. This legislation that has led us here was written in 1987 in a very different time and in is very intertwined with the complex history surrounding the HIV epidemic, but we feel that it's
2012. We have great treatments for HIV. HIV means something different today, and it's time for a change. At this time, I would like to pass you on to our...
I'm going to try and get Mike on the phone right now, if this is a good spot
Absolutely,
for you.
This is a great time. Great. So who she's reaching right now is Michael Kaplan. He is the executive director of Cascade AIDS Project, which is...
Mr. Kaplan?
Yeah, I'm watching the hearing right now.
Excellent, excellent. So you're on speakerphone. Let me turn you up a little bit. You want to... There you go. Excellent.
And introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you. Chairman Anderson and members of the committee, I first want to apologize for not being there in person, but due to Portland Public Schools closing, I just felt like I couldn't put a five-year-old in your chambers.
Thank you.
But let me say why the perspective I bring. I'm talking to you today as both someone who has lived with HIV for 20 years.
Michael, can you just say your name and your title for the record?
My name is Michael Kaplan, K-A-P-L-A-N. Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I work as the executive director of Cascade AIDS Project, the largest and oldest AIDS service organization in Oregon, and also speak to you from the perspective of an individual living with HIV. We are strongly in favor of the proposed change to the legislation. One of the biggest arguments we see in favor is research that came out in May of this 2011 from the National Institutes of Health, which showed that access to early treatment could help prevent transmission of HIV from a positive individual to their sexual partners by 96%. That's huge. That means nationally, we could take the 40,000 new cases that happen each year that are sexually transmitted, if we got everyone in the U.S. to know their HIV status and on to early treatment, down to less than a few thousand. At Cascade AIDS Project, we test more than 3,000 people each year, but the case binding should be happening in community-based organizations. It needs to happen within the health system. As Dr. Seaman mentioned, the CDC recommends routine screening for anyone sexually active from ages 13 to 64. Looking at CDC data from 2006, one indicator of how we are doing in early case finding is the percentage of individuals who are testing HIV positive and who have either developed AIDS at the time of testing or within 12 months. Nationally, that average is 36%. In Oregon, where we have more barriers to routine testing, 44% of people testing will have AIDS at the time of testing or within 12 months. We are not finding the cases soon enough, and the barriers that are out there are the reason for it. As someone who has lived HIV positive for 20 years with the new research that came out from the NIH in May, for the first time we can see how to end this epidemic. But we won't do it without case finding. We believe that simple verbal conversation regarding testing should be more than sufficient, and any additional barriers to offering routine HIV testing should be removed.
Thank you. Question? Yes, Senator Shields.
Thank you, Chair. Ms. Anderson, do we have any sense of what the CPT code is for AIDS testing or what the reimbursement rates are, because that often seems to influence how often a test seems to be taken.
Right. I think what you're getting at is insurance coverage or claims. No, I do not know the CPT number. What I can say is that a test for HIV costs between $12 and $16. So much, much less than the cost of treating someone for once they already have HIV, which is in the hundreds of thousands.
And Madam Chair, Senator Shields, what we do know is that at least the Affordable Care Act will mandate it to be covered for all women as preventative service. We've made several attempts through individual insurance companies and Oregon Health Plan and others to figure out what the coverage is, and have met with lots of difficulty there. But my general understanding is definitely for diagnostic purposes, so if you can say there's a reason to suspect HIV, it's covered. For no risk factors associated, it's a little less clear to me, but we'll try to continue to try to figure that out for you.
Madam Chair, can I follow up?
Yes.
I'm sure somebody, who, particularly in a primary care setting, can probably tell you what the CPT code is for that. If you could get that to my office, I'd be interested, because my guess is that you probably get reimbursed less than $12 to $16, and that might have something to do with why people aren't doing it as much as they should.
Great, thank you. So we, working with technology, had been hoping that we could provide testimony or have another witness speak to you. That would be Dr. Todd Korthuis, who is an HIV care provider at OHSU and also the director of research of the HIV program at OHSU.
Do we have his number?
We do not have his number, unfortunately. If we can obtain a written testimony from him, we will certainly pass that along to you.
I can offer his number if that's helpful at this moment.
Oh, that would be helpful.
Yes, can we take him off of the public?
503.
Okay.
810.
Eight. Going to the world.
Yeah. Okay, 810.
You should call him and get
it.
Why don't we have Christina call you so we don't broadcast his number publicly?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
That's all right.
Just keep him on.
Okay. You're still live, Michael.
Yeah. So, or you can text it if you have your phone.
I'm doing that right now.
Okay, he's texting the number to you, and then you
I'm
get
sorry,
it.
This is not going more smoothly.
Yes, Senator Bates.
I want to make sure we're kind of clear what we're trying to do here, and I'll be very politically incorrect for a few minutes.
Thank you.
You know, 20 years ago or thereabouts, when this first became a major epidemic for us in the healthcare field, we were afraid people wouldn't get tested because it was associated then with a certain lifestyle or sexual orientation, and we wanted to protect those people so they would get tested. And I think the public perceptions and feelings about this have changed dramatically since then, as a general rule.
Yes.
And now we find that the things we put in place 20 years ago are actually not working for us as well as we'd like. They're actually blocking us from getting the tests done. People are more open about this disease now. And I think what you're trying to do here, if I understand it, is bringing law up to matching what our culture is saying now is appropriate to do. If I had to go through testing for hepatitis C or for strep throat or anything else with the same protocol I have to use for HIV, I just couldn't get it done. And it does, in my practice, and Senator Shields may be able to help us here too, it is a barrier for us. I mean, we haven't got time to do that. And you feel sometimes almost a little uncomfortable bringing it up yet to patients and going through it. And I actually have patients asking for the test as often as I suggest the test. And it shows that I'm probably not culturally there yet either, okay? But I think what you're trying to do, as I understand it, is essentially saying, for HIV testing, we're to put it in the same category as we do all other testing of this nature. A quick explanation between the patient and the doctor is all that's required, and we can move forward with the test. Is that what we're trying to get to with this this language?
Madam Chair, Senator Bates, that's absolutely correct. Those are the aims that we are trying to achieve, and thank you. You have also served as a witness from your own personal experience.
Yes. Madam Chair, I got to ask one question. Do you know who's opposed to this bill? Is there anyone opposed to it?
So we have spoken
ACLU.
With...
ACLU?
Yes,
I read the ACLU thing, and I couldn't quite figure out what they were saying.
They're coming up.
Are they?
Yeah.
Madam Chair and Senator Bates, I would say that we have spoken with just about everyone we can think of who has something to say about this bill, including the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems, who are, we are confident we'll support it. They will officially come out before February. The Division of Public Health and will also officially come out before February. And a number of other patient organizations outside of Cascade AIDS met with absolutely no opposition and, in fact, enthusiasm from everyone. We did have several occasions attempted to contact the ACLU and have provided them with bills and all of our language at every step of the way and have not yet heard back officially from them. But from everyone else we've spoken to, there's been no controversy. Thank you.
I do remember back when I was working for Multnomah County as a public health nurse in 1986 and 1987, there were nurses that did not even want to see AIDS patients. And out of the whole field team, there were only two of us that would go in to work with HIV patients. The fear was phenomenal, but now it's just really considered another sexually transmitted disease in my eyes, and so this is definitely the proper way to go. Okay, do we have a number? We're waiting.
Working on it. I had planned to go last and provide some concluding statements. So depending on time and whether we can connect.
No, that's all right.
Okay. Should I?
Senator Mona Sanderson, Senator Bates, one of the other comments that was made briefly that we weren't planning on saying in the testimony is, again, with 96% reduction in transmission with treatment, we also would add 50% reduction in transmission just knowing your status from reducing sexual high-risk behaviors, et cetera, that we can prevent. With each transmission, we prevent estimated savings of $385,000.
Yes.
Yes, this is Sandy from the Senate Health Care and Human Services Rural Health Policy Committee.
I'm listening on the video feed. Sorry for the mix-up.
No, that's okay. Excellent. You are live. Let me try. I'm hoping I didn't disconnect Mr. Kaplan.
Okay.
I don't know how to get him back. Debbie?
Call him again. Can we go back to...
I don't know. It goes in...
Yes.
Yes. Who do we have?
Dr. Cortes from OHSU.
Okay, let's go ahead
okay.
and have him
yes.
testify.
You may proceed.
Please state your name and who you are.
My name is Dr. Todd Cortes. I'm a general internist and also HIV provider at Oregon Health Science University and director of the HIV research program and prevention there. First of all, Chairman Mona Sanderson, thank you so much for the invitation, and I apologize for not being there for weather-related conditions also. But I feel strongly enough about this issue that I am happy to field questions from the general public on my cell phone.
Oh, thank you.
Well played.
One of the most important barriers, as we've heard, performing routine HIV testing in healthcare settings turns out to be the rigorous consent process that you've heard about. We, in 2009, surveyed primary care providers, general internists across the United States who were practicing in outpatient primary care settings and asked them what they thought of their attitudes and behaviors about routine testing. And even though 88% of internists were aware of the CDC recommendations, they reported that they had only tested about 2% of their patients in the preceding month. And so we asked them why. Why is this so hard? And one of the top reasons was the requirement that many states have for written special consent for HIV testing, which takes actually quite an enormous time in the context, about 15 or 20 minutes patients encounter. Internists who practice in states with consent statutes that were inconsistent with the CDC guidelines were nearly three times more likely to identify HIV consent requirements as a primary barrier for adopting routine screening with their patients. And so I would view LC 182 as a way to ease the conversation between patients and providers
and as you've heard from Mr. Kaplan and others, really move forward the number of folks in the United States who know what their HIV status is and get easily treated as positive. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Questions?
Wow.
Yes, Senator Shields.
I did find a good thing about having your laptop here. Evidently, the CPT code for the test product is 86701 with modifier 92. And so I'd be interested I know this is proprietary information, top secret that the insurers can't tell the world, but I'd be interested in just seeing if people are actually getting reimbursed less what it costs them to buy the tests. And if anybody can help me get that answer, whether it's the health authority, OHSU or others, I'd be interested in the topic. I think I support what you're trying to do. I want to hear the testimony from the ACLU, or at least the end goal. But I also am interested in what else might be causing people not to do these tests.
Senator, this is Dr. Cortes. I can't speak to the CPT code issue, but in our survey, we specifically asked providers about reimbursement, and only 16% identified it as a barrier to testing.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Christina.
Good morning, Chair and members of the committee. My name is Dr. Christina Bauman, and thank you for this opportunity to speak in favor of LC-182. I am a primary care provider in Portland. I'm also a preventive medicine resident and obtaining a degree in Master's of Public Health. You have heard how burdensome testing policies can negatively influence testing practices. In Oregon, only 37% of people ages 18 to 64 have ever had an HIV test. And in addition, too many people are getting diagnosed at a late stage of HIV when they already are within a year of getting the diagnosis of AIDS. We need to change our testing policy if we are ever going to change this trend. LC-182 modifies the current Oregon laws regarding HIV testing by eliminating the problematic requirement for specific informed consent. The policy would be simplified to requiring that a person be notified if an HIV test may be performed and given an opportunity to decline testing. In Oregon, we're slowly moving away from the regulations around HIV testing that were initially imposed in the late 1980s. In 2005, prenatal HIV testing was exempted from the informed consent process to prioritize the health of mothers and babies. In 2012, we believe that it is time to do the same for others who are at risk for HIV infection. We believe that this policy change will have several benefits. It will decrease the actual and perceived barriers to offering testing. It will allow flexibility in HIV screening programs. It will streamline the testing process. And importantly, HIV testing remains a voluntary choice. In conclusion, with the current HIV testing policy, there has been a lack of progress in finding and preventing new HIV infections. LC-182 will help address this problem by decreasing barriers to HIV testing. Oregonians will benefit from earlier diagnosis, prevention of new infections, and decreased overall cost to the healthcare system. I sincerely hope that the committee moves forward with LC-182, and I thank you for this opportunity to testify before you. I certainly welcome any questions as well.
Thank you very much. No further questions? All right. Thank you, Dr. Bauman and Dr. Seaman and Dr. Corthius. And we lost Dr. Kaplan, but thank you all.
Thank you.
What? Yeah, the doctors do look young compared to some. All right, with that, I'd like to call Becky Strauss from the ACLU of Oregon.
Good morning, Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee. My name is Becky Strauss. I'm here today representing the ACLU of Oregon. I should note that Dr. Seaman did contact us, and I apologize that we haven't been able to connect. We've had some staff transitions in the office and also have been looking for an opportunity to consult with our national office sort of on positioning about this issue. So I do hope for the opportunity to work with him further
as this bill gets worked out. We absolutely agree that increasing access to HIV testing and care is a critically important goal. At the same time, while we do believe that HIV testing should be widespread, it also must be voluntary and informed. And the concern that I have, while it seems like testimony from the proponents is encouraging that, I'm a little worried about the language of the bill as it's written, particularly the part about allowing for that consent within a generic medical consent form. I think that there are some important things that specific informed consent provides to patients as is. I mentioned in my written testimony, and I'll just kind of go over those. It opens an important dialogue between provider and patient, and that's something that's necessary to build trust and continue the relationship should treatment be needed further down the road. And there's something unique about HIV testing, and we've touched on it a little bit in the hearing so far. Both legally and socially, and really with the nature of care that needs to happen ongoing if diagnosed. And while we have made a lot of progress as a society, I think that there is a real risk of discrimination ongoing with a diagnosis, and also that patients should be informed that those test results may be reported to the state. So there's some privacy issues there as well, and these are not things that we can't overcome, but I think that it's important that we preserve the important functions of what exists now, which are voluntary consent, informed consent, opportunity to consult with a provider before testing, to really understand the nature of the testing and the nature of a result. So I think there may be room for compromise, and I hope for the opportunity to work with the proponents to see if we can find a compromise point. But at this point, we will be opposed to any opt-out structure that does not explicitly spell out in the statute that the patient needs notification, what their options are for testing, and what those what the results and consequences of testing might be.
So you view AIDS differently than you do syphilis, gonorrhea, chlamydia, that could all lead to very infertility and even to death if not treated appropriately.
Senator Montes-Anderson, I appreciate that question. I do think that there is something unique about HIV diagnosis, and again, we've touched on it on the hearing thus far. There's a social stigma. While we have come a long way over the decades, that still exists, and it just means that I think we should treat this differently.
I guess my reaction is when you actually have the community, the AIDS community, coming forth and saying that this is what we want, we realize now that we can be diagnosed sooner, we can cut down having the death penalty of acquiring AIDS, I think that maybe ACLU may be a little archaic in viewing, thinking AIDS has such a stigma now. So think about that too. All right, comments. Yes, Dr. Morris, or Senator Morris. I'm all these doctors around me.
Well, thank you for that new status. This, I think, maybe is a question for Dr. Bates. Are there any other medical tests that require an affirmative approval by the patient?
Not in my knowledge. No, I'm going to limit myself here by saying my knowledge. If you're going in for a surgical situation, yeah, it has to be affirmative. But for just simple testing, and I think of other things besides what you've talked about, hepatitis B and C,
that's right.
You know, we don't go through this process, and they sign a general medical release, and we can go ahead and do the testing we want to do. It gets a little dicey sometimes in urine tests for illicit drugs and whatnot, but we still do those. This is really truly a separate category, and I'm going to support the chair on this 100%. I think she's absolutely right, and the way she spoke to it was exactly right. The stigma is not there like it used to be. It just isn't anymore. And when the community comes to you and says, we want broad testing, that speaks to me. And I think the chair was absolutely correct in what she said, and And I understand your concerns at ACLU. You're always trying to protect the rights of the individual, and I appreciate that. But I think in this one, society's moved on, and some of us, myself included, haven't quite moved on as far as we should. And that's part of the education process we're going through. So I'm there. And I'm going to be hard to move off this. I think we need broad testing, and I think Senator Mons Anderson is right on target here.
Are there further comments? Thank you so much for your testimony. With that, I'll close the public hearing on LC 182, and I'll open, is Senator Winters here? Yes, I'll open a public hearing on LC 18 relating to payment for prescription drugs.
Okay, I believe I have to apologize. I don't think the members have copies.
LC 18?
Yeah, it doesn't look like it made it.
Okay, we don't have a copy of it, but go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Senator Jackie Winters representing District 10, which is, I'll do like Senator Courtney, Salem, Monmouth, Independence, Almsville, and Turner. I want to thank you for the opportunity to share with you one of my priorities for the upcoming legislative session. LC 18 would restore the critical protection that was formerly in place for those suffering from cancer, HIV/AIDS, organ transplantation, and seizures. I know that Senator Bates and Senator Cruz was here in 2001 when these drugs were part of the legislative carve-out that we did in those years. And this drug was, we did that to protect patients' access as well as the mental health drugs. And I know you've had quite a conversation this morning about access and safety, patient safety. In 2009, I led the sessions long negotiations to authorize prior authorization of certain Medicaid prescriptions subject to final word of the prescribing practitioner. And as some of you will recall, we did that to assure that the mental health individuals would continue to have access. We would not play Russian roulette with this population. And during that same time, we also had for the HIV/AIDS and organ transplant and those as a refill only, if you can. And Dr. Bates is shaking his head, yes.
For the record.
For the record. I present this because even though today I'm not aware of any discussion that would take this PDL off, and also because of that, there is no fiscal impact. I always have the concern that as we get into our discussion about cost savings and some of those other issues, that we sometimes will go ahead and do some things that eliminates those protections of those entities that we have tried to protect several years ago. And it's for that reason that I bring this LC forward. I'm very concerned in this environment that we do not put at risk the population that I just described. We went through a lot of discussion in this building, and it from 2001, I think we did again in 2003, in 2009, and I become concerned each session as we grapple with the issue of budget, as we grapple with the issue of policy. And to be quite honest, I do think that we don't sacrifice policy, which is good policy, when we're actually dealing with budget. If we want to make some reductions, I think we do that. But the policy that's in place was done by some of the members that are sitting here today and myself because we believed that the whole PDL required that when the physician or the prescribing physician who had seen the individual, particularly in these classes, say, do not substitute, we don't do so. And it's for that reason that I bring this particular class before you as one of my priority legislation this session. And as I said earlier, I do not believe that there is a fiscal impact on this because so far there's no indication that the agency is going to not continue the effort. So with that, if there's any questions, I'm happy to answer them, but I'm sure that my good senators can also answer the same questions.
Just a clarification question. Senator Winters, just for clarification, the line reads, is a drug indicated for treatment of seizures, cancers, HIV, or AIDS. And I would like to make it clear that when we're speaking of a drug for the treatment of cancer, we're also talking about drugs who might be preventative for cancer. And
absolutely.
I'm talking about hepatitis C here. There are regimens for hepatitis C, and if these patients aren't treated for hepatitis C, many of them will, as a result of hepatitis C, develop liver cancer. I would assume that you are including hepatitis C treatments in this.
You're absolutely correct.
Thank you. Just to get our intent down.
Have you worked with the health authority?
I have not on this one, but I am working with the health authority on the one that you just heard, LC-181, in conversation with them to talk to them about whether or not we can do the data that is being requested by the pilot without having legislation and to assure there is no carve-out. And so, in fact, I'm having a meeting this afternoon with Tom Burns. I have met with Dr. Goldberg and have met with the governor's office on this particular issue on 181.
On 181.
And so I will be talking to them about this one as well.
Because I think that this might be controversial. And so I'm worried that there hasn't been a whole lot of work during the interim on that, because I want to be ready to go in February, because we can't take time for a lot of amendments and then fiscals, et cetera. So it'll be important to work with the health authority on this.
Actually, it's no different than what we're currently doing, but I understand your concern. And I don't know anything that we don't do in this building that's not controversial. So, but here again, you know, the intent is it's a group that we currently are covering. It's a group that I think that those of us who have worked on this for years and who have attempted to make certain that this group is not at risk. It would be different if we're talking, I heard earlier some discussion of talking about generics. You know, to be quite honestly, if I was an individual who's being treated for HIV, AIDS, cancer, or some of the things that we're talking about, I don't want to, as a policymaker, to play Russian roulette. And we went through 03, if I can recall, where, and for budget considerations, there was huge discussion. There was also, and I can't remember the individual's name, who we had some tragic fallouts as a result of budget reductions. I just don't want, personally, to go there. I think that this was thoughtful when we did it in 01 and 03, and so I just want the assurance that we will continue that thoughtfulness in the policy that we did then. And so that's my motivation. I will work with the agency on it, but for the record, I think that we, as my mother told me, we can be penny wise and pound foolish, as the good Dr. Bates described. If you don't do the proper treatment, it ends up costing us not only in the human capital, but it costs us more in the dollars as well. So that's my reason for it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. Yes, Senator Cruz.
Madam Chair, just to reinforce what Senator Winter said, both on this one and 181. I mean, it's been our decision and position we took and have fought for a long time that some things we do are not based on dollars and cents, or based on what's best for the people. And I think this is in that area. So
other further comments?
I think we can get there with education of providers is a better way of doing it than this, but we hear you clearly.
Thank you, Senator Worden, so much. I'm so glad we were able to get on the agenda, since I didn't know about this until some other representatives came forward from the...
And even though we were flying together.
Okay. Okay. All right. Thank you.
We're in first class, were you? Yeah.
Okay.
No, it's a coach.
Yeah.
All right. I'll close the public hearing on LC 18 and open... Okay, let's...
You want to go back and...
Okay. Yeah.
Do you want to do the work session?
Yeah, let's open a work session on LC 173, 174, 180, 181, and 182.
Madam Chair, I move that LC 173 dated 1-12-12, LC 174 dated 12-22-11, LC 180 dated 1-6-12, LC 181 dated 1-17-12, and LC 182 dated 1-17-12 be introduced as committee bills.
Senator Cruz has moved the LC 173, 174, 180, 181, and 182 to be introduced as committee bills. Is there any discussion? Is there any opposition? They're on their way. So ordered, they're on their way to becoming bill numbers. All right, now we are going to go, we've already heard one personal bill. LC 18 will now open public hearing on LC 86, and we have Shane Jackson, Paul Turdall, and Toby Rates.
And just for the record, Madam Chair, we have not received the LC yet. Apparently they were waiting for a revision, and hopefully they will have had that. They have that now.
Please introduce yourself and
Madam
proceed.
Madam Chair, I'm Shane Jackson. I'm the lobbyist for the Autism Society of Oregon, represented here today by Toby Rates and Autism Speaks, and somewhat represented by Paul Trudell here. I'm sorry about the mix-up there. I sent the old copy of the LC as an attached copy to everybody here, and we were waiting for LC to bring a slightly revised copy here, but we couldn't get it to you today. We can the changes are very slight, very minor, and we can operate mostly off of the former LC, if we don't mind, for the purposes of today's hearing. And for the... For out of respect to your time, that's all I'm going to say today.
I didn't.
Okay. We don't have the old one in front of us, so.
Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson and Senators. For the record, I'm Toby Rates. I reside at 8144 Southeast 62nd Avenue in Portland, 97206. I am here today in my capacity as the Executive Director of the Autism Society of Oregon, the Treasurer of the Portland Asperger's Network, and the mother of two children on the autism spectrum. The Autism Society of Oregon is the state's largest autism group. We represent everyone affected by autism in Oregon, including individuals on the autism spectrum, their families, and their caregivers. Our mission is to empower these individuals to improve their lives through support and information. Statewide, over 4,700 people actively participate in the Autism Society of Oregon. We have volunteer chapter representatives in every region in Oregon. We cover all eight regions based on the ESD regions. Each year, ASO hosts an autism walkathon. This year will be our 10th. The walkathon is the largest autism awareness event in Oregon, attended by over 4,000 people last year. ASO also provides information and support through our comprehensive website, our statewide toll-free phone number, email contacts, and our newsletter. We sponsor both online and in-person support groups. We have monthly workshops held throughout the state. We provide a very popular program that gives parents an evening of respite care, and we host an annual full-day conference. At the Portland Asperger's Network, we represent individuals affected by Asperger's syndrome and other forms of high-functioning autism in the Portland metro area. PAN hosts an online community chat group of over 800 people, a monthly game club, a teen club, and several support groups. I'm here today in support of LC 86, which will clarify and reinforce existing law to require that people on the autism spectrum have insurance coverage for autism treatments. These medically necessary, evidence-based therapies help individuals on the autism spectrum live more functional and productive lives and reduce their dependence on government supports. This LC deserves to become a bill. And this is the time for this bill is now. We have already had years of conversation with all the stakeholders, and the need for what this bill does is overwhelming and growing. As Representative Greenlich has said, we are facing an autism tsunami. We at ASO and PAN look forward to the passage of this bill and to joining 29 other states in providing insurance coverage of autism treatments. Thank you for your time.
Chair Monis Anderson, members of the committee, my name is Paul Trudell. I live at 700 Northwest McClay Boulevard in Portland, Oregon. I also represent Autism Speaks as their statewide policy chair and a coalition of about 700 or so parents, family members, individuals with autism, medical providers, and educators who are very much in support of this issue. It's great to be back, talking to you again, and thank you again for your unanimous support of SB 555 in last year's session. We're coming again with a revised version of that bill. We have, over the last 6 months, we've had a number of discussions with stakeholders, including members of the representatives from the insurance industry and other associations, to really clean up and improve the policy and the content of the bill. We had in the handout I gave you on the back, there's a sort of a summary of some of the kinds of things that we did with their input. Specifically, we have really tightened the credentialing requirements for providers of the applied behavior analysis treatment or therapy. We're a lot more specific. We have a tighter structure for how they would be regulated that would really make this, I think, the tightest and the cleanest regulation of any of the 29 states that are already doing this treatment. We have cleaned up the definition of behavioral health treatment to make it more consistent with the Federal Health Care Reform Act. Previously we had a cumbersome and sort of unique definition of medical necessity. We basically deleted that and allowed insurance companies to basically apply whatever definition they have for other conditions to autism. We have cleaned up the language on utilization controls and utilization review. The intent, we're still keeping what we had always intended, but it's language that some of the insurance companies felt they were much more comfortable with, to clarify that what we're looking for is utilization controls based on an individual's medical necessity rather than a specific hard and fast limit. There are also a number of technical corrections to some of the definitions and other kinds of things within the bill. Basically, as Toby said, this is really, really about reinforcing and clarifying the laws that we already have. Oregon already has a great mental health parity law that does cover autism. We already have a specific bill requiring coverage for autism. The problem has been that getting that enforced effectively and getting actual treatment through that has been very challenging. There are a handful of people, including my own son, who are now getting the intensive treatment through through those existing laws, but it is a tiny fraction of the patients who are actually successfully able to use the laws to get the treatment that they need. And this is really about streamlining the process, clarifying what we've already got, and getting treatment into the people who need it. We understand budgets are tight, and we think the fiscal argument in behalf of this bill is one of the best arguments that we have. We estimate that the state is currently spending $200 million per biennium or more on special education services for kids with autism alone, based on the more than 8,000 kids who have autism. And if those kids had access to evidence-based medical care for their autism, a lot of that demand could be reduced, and a lot of those kids would become much higher functioning and grew up to being tax-paying adults and productive members. So we are very enthusiastic about this bill. We think it is a great concept. We think it is greatly improved over where we were last year with input from the insurance industry and other stakeholders, and we very much look forward to a successful session this year. Thank you.
I know a personal friend who is a high-functioning he's a high-functioning autistic person. He's in his 60s now or 70s, and his concern about this is that that sometimes families become see that ABH therapy works and sees how it works in one child, where he feels the majority this therapy would not work, and so we would be paying for something with the family wanting it to succeed, and it's not going to work. Do you have reaction
sure.
or comment on that?
If I may, Chair Mona Sanderson, the one truism about autism that you hear is that when you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person. Everyone is unique in how they manifest and also unique in what therapies are helpful to them and which are not. And I agree with your friend's concern. ABA is absolutely very effective and useful in some cases, but certainly not in all, and certainly not everyone on the autism spectrum, or even probably a majority of people on the autism spectrum, need or would benefit from ABA therapy. But there is a substantial portion of people who would. That being said, that's why in this bill there are review standards in place. There are to make sure that medically necessary therapies are being provided to people. Nothing in this bill would require ABA therapy to be provided where it's not effective, and no one wants that to happen. That doesn't help any of our constituent base, and it certainly isn't something that the other stakeholders would like to see. So I hear your friend's concern, and it's well taken, but I think this bill addresses that head on.
Two other concerns that I've heard, and again, these things need to be worked out before February 1st, is credentialing. There is still opposition to the credentialing in the bill, as well as family members.
Okay,
and so those two need to be worked out, hopefully, so that there is no opposition and we can hurry up and get the bill through.
So if I can just, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee, if I can just briefly speak to those last two issues. We are very interested in any ideas on improving the credentialing standards. What we have done is we have basically taken the best structure from all of the other states that have similar legislation. We modeled the credentialing standards that we have on what TRICARE is currently using for Department of Defense dependents. So it is basically the highest standard in use. As a regulatory structure, what we have outlined basically links it to an existing program that DHS is already doing, a behavior consultant program. The sense has been that it's simply not practical to create yet another licensing board for this function. Not that there's any objection to it, it's just as a practical matter, it's just not plausible at this point. If any of the other stakeholders have an idea for an improvement on credentialing, we are very happy, to talk to them about that. On the issue with the family members, I personally am somewhat indifferent to that. In discussions with the SEIU, they mentioned that they do have a number of, do you want to talk about that one?
Sure. They feel that home health care. Okay. Madam Chair, thank you very much. The unions feel that the inclusion of family members as becoming qualified line providers is a very efficient method of delivering services, and there is no reason, by their understanding, why family members cannot, if they have the capacity, to become certified as line providers and provide those services very effectively. So that's why we put it, we, on their suggestion, we structured it that way.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Comments? Yes, Dr. Bates.
Just sort of a little different perspective. Is this a sort of a consensus bill now? Are the insurers basically supportive of this bill? You obviously had a lot of conversations with them. So I'd like to know, and then they can speak for themselves, obviously, and actually do a pretty good job of it. I'd like to hear from you just real quick.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. They will, of course, speak for themselves. We have had a number of great discussions with a couple of insurers, specifically Pacific Source and Regions, have given us some really good feedback. We had hoped that they would be ready to support something. The feedback that they have given me is that they basically just want to keep talking about it for another year or so. The kinds of things that they have told me, for instance, they sort of ran out of policy things that they wanted us to change. They basically said was that, we need to keep talking and we should be talking about what should the role of education be, what should the role of community services be, and so forth. And as someone who volunteered with the Autism Commission's Role of Insurance Committee, which did have all of that representation involved, we need to get on with it. We've been talking for years. We have 600 new cases of autism every year. We have 8,000 children alone who already have autism, plus adults like your friend. And it's time.
Okay, I do want to say I think we have to move on because this committee has heard this bill a lot. And so the credentialing and the family member are two. Those are the only two that have come from the insurers that they're concerned about. There may be others, but they will bring that forward. But remember, we have, I think, five committee meetings, six committee meetings, and everything has to be out. So we can't really have bills that aren't really ready for prime time. Okay.
Madam Chair,
that's
one quick question, then we'll move on. I think the issue is fidelity to the ABA model of whoever developed it said these kinds of people can implement it. Could you find, you don't have to answer it now, but could you get to all of us any type of documentation in the literature that indicates that a family member is qualified to be a provider in this instance?
I can certainly get that information for you, yes.
Thanks.
Thank you so very much, and we'll be seeing you in a couple weeks.
Great, thanks.
All right. With that, I'll close the public hearing on LC 86, open a public hearing on LC 241, and Lynn Bergstein and Bill Cross, please come forward. Please proceed.
Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee, my name is Leonard Bergstein, and I'm testifying on behalf of my client ZoomCare in support of LC 241. ZoomCare is a leader in providing access to affordable, high-quality, convenient health care in state-of-the-art neighborhood clinics in Oregon and Seattle, Washington. ZoomCare is founded in 2006 by David Sanders and Dr. Albert DePiro, and more information is available, as I've indicated in my comments. There are six key points to LC 241. It's a better bill than came to you last time, and it represents a broad consensus that you'll hear us talk about in just a moment. It's a bill to authorize physician assistants and nurse practitioners to dispense non-narcotic medications they can now prescribe. LC 241 builds on and improves Senate Bill 952 from the 2011 regular session, which passed the Senate 26 to 3. Here are my six points. LC 241 2041 would provide increased access to affordable, quality health care and provide new employment opportunities for Oregon's primary care workforce of highly trained nurse practitioners and physician assistants. LC 241 would require drug outlets, as currently defined in the statutes, to register with the Board of Pharmacy, complying with rules adopted by the Board of Pharmacy. Drug outlets would then submit additional documents, which are outlined in Section 2 of this bill, and receive approval from the Oregon Medical Board for physician assistants to dispense. LC 241 addresses public safety issues by ensuring that a physician assistant must pass a drug dispensing program jointly developed and adopted by the Oregon Medical Board and Board of Pharmacy. That's language that the Coalition and the Board of Pharmacy wanted, and we've put into the bill. LC 241 would remove existing limitations on nurse practitioners, providing that the Board of Nursing may grant dispensing authority to nurse practitioners beyond areas that lack readily available access to pharmacy services. That's a limit now on how nurse practitioners can dispense. LC 241 would create an innovative clinical team of pharmacists, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners providing patients with complete and convenient care. As a matter of fact, that would be a unique group. It would really a unique teamwork on the part of a clinical team involving those disciplines. And the last point I'll make is that LC 241 would be a modest but meaningful reform that will complement the other healthcare reform initiatives enacted by the Oregon Legislature to increase access to affordable care. We have, Chair Moniz and members of the committee, worked very diligently with Bill Cross, his coalition, and the Board of Pharmacy to try and remove the points of controversy. As it relates to physician assistance, I believe we are at total consensus, and with a couple of word changes that will be before the committee before February 1. The sole issue remains has to do with the definition of drug outlet, whether or not the we have this practitioner dispensing drug outlet that we have in this Section 30, it's in the bill before you, or whether that's deleted and we just rely on the existing statutory language that says drug outlet. There, both of those are that's the issue that we're kind of spinning around, because that determines whether or not practitioners will be caught up in this bill, or whether it would just whether it would be up to the Board of Pharmacy and the other boards to work that out. So we are very close, I would say, much closer than we have been at any point yet to resolving all these issues, with one tiny issue about this definition, and then I think we will have that resolved. Obviously, others will testify, but we will have that resolved by February 1 to go by the rule that you've said, that there will be no controversy in order to have bills move forward. So I'll stop there, but I wanted to tell you that the work that you did last session, the work you've encouraged us to do, we've reflected with hard work with Bill Cross and the group of the Pharmacy Coalition and the Board of Pharmacy to get this bill to the point where it really works to get this clinical team together on this issue of dispensing. I'll stop there, Chair.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Bill Cross. I'm here today representing the Oregon Pharmacy Coalition. And we have, as you've heard from Mr. Bergstein, made some substantial progress on the concept of having a physician's assistant authorized to dispense out of practitioner dispensing drug outlets. We'll refer to them that way, in that we believe the patient safety issues that were of concern to our association, our organizations, will be addressed in the approach that Zoom Care has looked at in this bill, where it relates to physician assistance and establishing a regulatory relationship with the Board of Pharmacy that would require them to comply with the appropriate rules, you know, regarding the drugs and the storage, inventory, control, security, consultation. And that's we've been working on the conceptual language for that. There would be an additional section, and I think, you know, we're pretty much there. The issue, as Mr. Bergstein's pointed out, is whether or not we have the broader reference to the practitioner dispensing drug outlets. We feel that's very important because that establishes a path for other practitioner dispensing outlets. And recently, Idaho took the same tact and developed what they call a prescriber drug outlet to there again enable certain practitioners who do want, who already have prescribing authority and who do want to dispense, to follow then a regulatory path to ensure that there again the patient safety issues from the pharmacy perspective or pharmacy side are addressed. So we feel that's very important, and we do need to resolve that yet with the sponsor of the bill. We also are opposed to the bill if it contains Section 8 as it relates to nurse practitioners, unless as nurse practitioners are allowed to dispense drugs. There again, if that same path were to be followed by that dispensing drug outlet model, then we'd be very comfortable with their, you know, the Board of Pharmacy trying to adopt appropriate rules for nurse practitioners, not regulating the nurse practitioners, but the outlets. So we, there are some issues that do need to be addressed in this bill. We will continue to work with Zoom Care and the others involved in the bill, but at this point we cannot publicly state that we support it as drafted.
Okay. Thank you. Yes, Senator Bates?
Been down this road before, and I'm going to throw some concerns I have out there, and maybe you can reassure me on them, maybe you can't. First off, I've supported Zoom Care bills that have come before us before on the basis that Zoom Care had a handshake, had agreed that within the two-year time they would start taking Medicare and Medicaid patients, not just private pay. I'd love to have practices with private pay in it and not have to take all the discounts financially on the others, but I think every physician would. So that was one issue, and I'd like to hear how that's progressing as far as taking Medicare and Medicaid patients. We don't have Zoom Care in my area of the state. We have urgent care clinics now, and they're becoming more and more of a difficulty for us. Because nights and weekends, I'm now getting phone calls from patients who were seen at urgent care, have a problem with the prescription, have a problem with the treatment, and whereas urgent care is a 9-to-5 or 9-to-6 operation, and we're 24/7. It's becoming a bigger issue for us. The vast majority of patients seen there are being seen for something simple, and they're fine, but they have a drug reaction, something goes wrong in the evening after being seen or on a weekend. The rest of us are picking up the ball on that, and it's getting to be more and more of an issue for us. Patients love quick and easy care until something goes wrong. This is not a 9-to-5 business. This is a 24/7-hour business. I carry a cell phone and a beeper at times, and I'm on call 24/7 unless one of my partners is covering. So that's the two issues I'm concerned about. The third issue is some of us have tried situation where we actually dispense drugs. We have the right to do that. And we felt that we were not doing a good job for two reasons. One, we could make mistakes, and we didn't have that double check on prescriptions that we get from pharmacists, and they are really part of the team with us. We do occasionally write a prescription incorrectly, or we've not realized of an interaction, or another physician's writing something we don't know about, calmly caught at the pharmacy level, and the pharmacists are really helpful to us in that. And we rely on them to help us. So that's a big issue, too, one that I'd like to hear their perspective on. The other one is that when you're in a situation where you're dispensing drugs that you're making usually a profit on, and you have a limited number of them, you're not going to carry all the drugs that a pharmacy does, you have a tendency to start moving towards the drugs you have at your fingertips instead of the drug that potentially might be the best for the patient. So there's a little conflict in your brain about that sometimes. And I think it's a conflict we don't need to put there in front of us. So I have concerns about this bill on a whole bunch of different levels, primarily from a safety point of view for the patient, more than anything else. And I'd just like to hear, you know, I'm sure this has been discussed, I'd like to hear what the thoughts are on all these issues. And my concerns about starting to dispense drugs out of how this situation is significant.
We're running close to our time limit, but can briefly, but definitely address those concerns by February.
Definitely by February. By February, we'll be announcing a program that will be coming out of the Zoom Care Foundation that addresses the questions you've asked about taking a broader share of customers that both you and Senator Shields have mentioned to us. We will be telling you about how we will be taking on our share of that load beyond just a paying customer. We are we go from 8 to 8, 362 days a year. We understand that. A concept of 24/7. We have docs. We have others who are on. There is a huge need in the marketplace for the service that we're providing, and it's not to shoulder and push the burden onto others, but we believe that we are, in fact, picking up an awful big load that's out there in the marketplace. In terms of the pharmacy question, we agree with you. If Dave Sanders was here, the co-founder of the program, he would be saying that the pharmacists are, in fact, play a critical role in the clinical team. We won't be able, as part of the pharmacy board's rules, we will hire a licensed pharmacist as part of our clinical team in order to be able to do a couple of things, write the policies, procedures, and be available as part of our clinical team to help all of the practitioners who are in our group to move forward and make sure that the pharmacist's perspective and patient safety is uppermost. We do not, we have a 50-drug formulary. We are not making money on this. This is a convenience to customer issue. I think we last time came in with that 50-drug formulary. We'd be glad to put that in the record again. We are not choosing to. We don't. I don't think there's an adverse selection in terms of drugs that we offer. We think that the Zoom Care practitioners on the clinical team are experts in everyday care, and we only carry the SKUs for those drugs that we need to implement that care. All those are all excellent points. We'll be much more fulsome in our responses to those questions, Senator Bates. I hope that addresses your questions.
Thank you.
We need to move on. Yes. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Close the public hearing on LC 241 and open a public hearing on LC 272. And Steve Wells from BioGift and Hasina Squires. BioGift is in my district, and I toured the facility and was very impressed.
Good morning, Chair Mona Sanderson and members of the committee. For the record, Hasina Squires on behalf of BioGift and MedCure, two non-transplant tissue banks facilities that are located in Gresham. With me today is Steve Wells from BioGift. In the interest of time, I know you have a heavy agenda, and out of respect to your admonition of bills that are not ready for prime time, I would characterize this bill as definitely not ready for prime time. I can run through the LC draft. What my clients are interested in is the ability to be regulated like tissue banks. There's a registry at the Oregon Health Authority, and my clients would like to be registered and or licensed via the Oregon Health Authority. Steve is here to just give a brief explanation of what BioGift is, the services that we provide, and we'll wrap it up.
We provide two vital services.
Introduce yourself.
I'm Steve Wells with BioGift, Madam Chairman and Committee Chair. BioGift is a whole-body anatomical donation company that accepts donations for non-transplantable use for the advancement of the medical sciences through either research or education purposes. It is one of the vital components for families to have another option versus a funeral or a traditional funeral. It's something that families can honor their loved ones by donating. This is something that is helps families as well in these economical times, and as well as providing an option for physicians to have the crucial training that is necessary for performing new and innovative surgeries that are coming up, as well as research and developing new technologies with the help of physicians so that they have the best instrumentation as well as surgical techniques so that when individuals have surgeries, they have less possibilities of infections, less time for recovery, and it's less evasive. With being regulated, we will have a way to be monitored and overseen and it will become more viable, and we'll be looked upon as an industry instead of in an infancy, but continue to grow and be able to provide services for both arenas, the consumer as well as the advancements of the medical sciences.
I find it very interesting, and it is a way, I mean, I assume that the bodies at OHSU, the research that they have, what we nurses worked on, what docs work on.
Yeah. With OHSU, what my understanding is, their anatomical donation is for studying and teaching anatomy, where ours is actually teaching or educating physicians that are already licensed, where they need to have the continuing education credits that they need, or they have to have the training that they need to perform a newer surgery that is better than what was previously taught to them.
Okay.
Yeah. One of the fun parts of being up here, I learned stuff I didn't know before. Again, I'm a doctor.
Oh.
I didn't hear this. So what you're talking about is you get a new procedure, laparoscopic, removal of a gallbladder. You've never been trained in that. It's something new that came along, and you can go to your facility and practice it on a cadaver, basically, right? Or you get a new prosthesis for a knee or a hip.
Exactly.
A new procedure for a hip replacement, a microsurgery. You can do it at your facility. Is that what you're talking about?
Exactly.
Very nice.
As well as the donation for providing a way. There's a lot of people that want to do donation or anatomical donation, but they don't fit the criterias for transplant or for the OHSU, and we are actually another avenue for the family to honor that person's wish. So it gives them an opportunity, because we can accept individuals who have illnesses like diabetes or cancer where they cannot for transplant or for studying of anatomy.
Okay.
Thank you
very much for coming and educating on this. I'll close the public hearing on LC-272 and open an informational hearing on update on strengthening families programs. And I'm sorry that we're limited on time, so brevity is appreciated.
Good morning, Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Erin Kelly Seal. I'm the director of the Department of Human Services, and normally Lois Day, my child welfare director, would have been here presenting, but for the fact that Oregon is achieving national recognition for some of the good work that we're doing in our child welfare program. And so she is up in Seattle in the 10 inches of snow having a conference and conversation about exactly this topic, how Oregon is working on safely and equitably reducing our foster care population in partnership with communities. I don't need to remind this committee much about this particular piece of legislation. All of you are listed as chief sponsors for it during the last legislative session, but in essence, this is a key piece of our ability in the state to codify the practice and the improvements in the child welfare system we're attempting to make to reflect our policy objectives about making sure that our foster care system is focused on safely serving kids at home when that's at all possible, and when kids need a placement in foster care, ensuring they can get home safely and stay home safely, as much as that is something we can play a role in. We believe we need to do that in partnership with communities. We believe that communities have a significant role to play and providers have a significant role to play in adapting their service delivery models to wrap around our clients and families differently than has been always the tradition in the past, and this bill pushes us in that direction. In the interest of time, I will just give you the update on our efforts to implement the legislation. As originally proposed and funded, this bill would have supported services in about 6 counties. We, based on the direction from legislative leadership and the governor, are starting with 3 counties because of the current budget climate that we're in. It felt like we needed to be a little more conservative going into the February session as the legislature is talking about some of the different budget issues. It's also been a challenge for us because the staff that have been associated with this particular piece of legislation and its implementation are primarily caught up in the statewide hiring freeze, and so we've not had the necessary administrative and programmatic support that otherwise was planned for to get the bill up and off the ground. The good news is we have selected our 3 initial counties. Those counties are
Jackson, Clackamas, and Malheur. The county selection was based on several different factors, urban, rural, looking for geographic diversity as much as possible, looking at characteristics of the foster care population and what the drivers of abuse and neglect are in the community, also looking at the capacity for community collaboration, as I mentioned, as being really pivotal to this. And of course, we were looking for readiness. Were people ready, willing, and desire? Did they desire to be part of this particular project? Each of the counties that were selective have very different services that are happening now. Jackson, of course, pretty advanced in terms of its service delivery continuum and has been doing good work for a while. Clackamas, urban setting with a lot of rural communities interspersed around it, but also has a variety of challenges, including a significant increase in their foster care population in the last year or so. Malheur County has extremely strong community relationships, but they're a very resource-poor community, and however, are very willing and wanting to participate in this. Also, we benefit from the Burns Paiute tribe being at the table there and significant racial and ethnic diversity in that county that we're going to be able to think more about in relation to this project. The legislation requires DHS to partner differently with our federal partnership around the waiver. It does leverage savings that have been achieved in the state due to our foster care population having been reduced in the last 5 years. And we have started the conversations at the federal level. Some good news is that the feds have allowed for some additional waiver authority. Before now, Oregon was only one of five waivers that had been authorized under the law by Congress. They've now increased that number. Our federal partners are encouraging us to wait a bit until the rules come out before we move down the road of a decision either to apply for one of the new waivers or to engage in a conversation about our existing waiver looking different. We have rules that need to be promulgated. Again, that's temporarily on hold as we're waiting for the staff support issue to get a little bit more resolved. Our next steps, the bill would like us to have these services in place in at least those three counties by October 1st of this year. We're hoping to hit that a little earlier, but as I said, are experiencing some challenges in terms of our staffing levels. The local managers in each of those counties are currently convening tables where they're preparing a gap analysis to really help us identify where some of the biggest challenges are in the community to achieve the intended programmatic outcomes that are laid out in the bill and the infrastructure that's required by the bill in order to implement the program, so we know what it is exactly we need to target our funding resources to. And in addition, at the state level, we're working to convene a central table, including housing and community services, to ensure that that key issue that's called out in the bill around the housing support services is something that's being talked about at both the state and local levels. I did want to remind the committee that this way of doing business is envisioned for the entire state, and so it's a little daunting to consider that right now we're really only contemplating three counties. We are looking forward to the ability to implement this statewide. We're also preparing for you a report for February about implementation of a new model for our front door of intervention, which we call differential response. Basically, this is a different way of engaging families that first become known to our system and support them differently by hopefully increasing the number of children who can stay safely at home with their parents. So these aren't an either-or. The Senate Bill 964 service continuum equation is part of a larger system reform effort that we're in the middle of here in Oregon, and we hope to continue.
Thank you very much.
Thank you again.
Yes.
The results in Jackson County have been dramatic. As you know, we've dropped our foster rolls by 50%. And Christian Care people are going to be doing the same thing in other parts of the state for us. And as I understand the legislation, there's nothing that prevents a county or an area from going forward with this with the funds they already have available if they can do that. This is just trying to help those, encourage those to start in other parts of the state. So if a county next door to us wanted to go to this kind of a program and wanted to do it within their own resources from the state and their own, there's nothing to prevent them from doing that. Correct?
Chairman Sanderson, Senator Bates, that's true.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. I'll close the informational hearing on our update on strengthening families programs and open an informational meeting on a presentation on the state of diabetes in Oregon. Nikki
Trozif and Tom Boyer. And we have to limit about 10 minutes for each presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Sanderson, members of the committee. My name is Nikki Terziev. I'm here today representing on behalf of Novo Nordisk. And we appreciate this opportunity to have this discussion with you on the state of diabetes in Oregon. Frankly, the news isn't great. We're talking about LC-151 eventually. And I want to just let you all know that I feel like it's imperative that we really discuss this and tackle this issue in February. Before I introduce my associate, Tom, I want to just give you a brief overview of this packet. I've been carrying it around all morning.
So, this may go down. Right. It's getting introduced in the sentence.
What you're going to find in there is written testimony, a letter from a woman named Margaret Baker. She's a constituent of the newest senator, Senator Siner Hayward, as well as Representative Greenlick. She's a nurse and a mother of a daughter with diabetes. She couldn't be here today. She got called into work, but she's planning on helping us with this conversation as we move forward. You'll also find a legislative priority announcement that contains a reference to the Diabetes Action Plan, which is, again, this LC-151. You'll see an NCSL legis brief. You'll see a diabetes research project, which is specific to Oregon, so it has a focus for us for our discussion moving forward in February. Some written testimony from Tom, my associate here, and he'll discuss a couple of desired edits that we'd like to see to the LC when it's up for consideration. A copy of model legislation from Kentucky, which passed unanimously as well. It passed unanimously in Texas most recently. And then a roadmap of our edits, which just includes some of our suggested language.
Have you tried to make those changes before they're passed out of committee?
Yes, it turns out we will not probably have time before it's introduced tomorrow. As you know, Chair Monis Anderson, Chair Boquist was generous enough to give us his bill.
And LC can't?
No, Cheyenne, Chair Monis Anderson, Cheyenne didn't feel like she would be able to squeeze that in.
The deadline for changes was last Friday.
Oh, last Friday evidently was the deadline for changes.
Oh, prior to the LC.
Okay, thank you.
All right. So I'll turn it over now.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Chair Monis Anderson, Vice Chair Cruz, members of the committee. I appreciate the time to be here. Again, I was here about just over a year ago now, similar weather, and I'm happy to be back. Just to give you a little background on the company that I work for and why I'm here. I actually have type 1 diabetes, but my company's been in the business of diabetes for about 87 years. We're the U.S. leader in insulin production and sales, and ensuring that people with diabetes are taken care of is very important to my company. My primary reason to be here is to call and encourage you to move forward this Diabetes Action Plan draft in the coming legislative session. I believe that this bill provides an opportunity for the state to bring together the best and the brightest from entities and agencies that ultimately have a real important role in safeguarding the health of Oregon taxpayers and people with diabetes throughout the state. I submitted more in-depth written testimony. Appreciate the opportunity to veer from that and to zero in my comments on the bill before us and a few other salient points. Before the committee is a legislative concept to implement the Diabetes Action Plan. The intent behind the concept is to empower the best and the brightest from state government agencies that have a vested interest to come together. The bill directs these agencies to work together on a plan to guide the legislature on how best to contain the diabetes epidemic in the near and also in the long term. The concept is a phenomenal first draft. This said, I strongly encourage the committee to make three very important changes to the bill. These edits help ensure the intent of the legislation is clear, while also ensuring the legislation remains fiscally neutral. Ideally, these three changes steer you closer to what was endorsed by the Council of State Governments as suggested state legislation, what was highlighted by the National Conference of State Legislatures, but it also ensures that the legislation is in line with what was endorsed by the American Diabetes Association's Board of Directors, its advocacy committee, and ultimately the entire association in late December 2011. A copy of the press release announcing that this is one of their core legislative priorities is included in the packet for your review. Assuming the changes are incorporated into the legislation, I believe that it will have a wide range of support. Again, though I can't speak for ADA, I believe that they will be on board if those three changes are in fact incorporated.
The financial burden of diabetes in America and Oregon really highlights the need for this legislation. The total financial cost of diabetes in 2007 nationwide was about $218 billion. In 2010, in Oregon, the cost of diabetes alone to your state economy is about $2.8 billion. $1.4 billion of that $2.8 went solely into hospital-based care. According to projections for 2025, the total cost of diabetes for Oregon will reach $5.4 billion, representing a 93% increase from today. Now, this model that I'm sharing with you was developed by an entity called the Institute for Alternative Futures based on CDC projections. This model was recently validated, and I share this piece of data with you so that you know that that 2025 figure that I just shared with you, $5.4 billion, you will likely reach it in 2021. 4 years earlier than projections, so less than 10 years from today. The need is also highlighted by the reach of diabetes within Oregon. Today, more than 291,200 people in your state live with diabetes, compared with just 204,000 in 2000. That's a 42% increase in a decade. An additional 965,600 Oregonians live with prediabetes, which is the primary precursor for diabetes, which is why we're going to see such an increase in the rate of the disease over the next decade. The burden of diabetes will also continue growing. Projections in 2025 suggest that 546,000 Oregonians will live with diabetes. That's an 87.5% increase from today. And the population with prediabetes will grow to 1.1 million people. That's a 19.6% increase from today. Diabetes, if not diagnosed, treated, and controlled, also leads to devastating complications, such as visual impairment, kidney failure, amputations of the lower extremities. Compared with rates in 2010, it's projected that in 2025, there'll be an increase of 106% on the visual impairment side of things, a 78% increase when it comes to kidney failure, and a 55% increase in the annual number of lower extremity amputations. This all has a dramatic impact on your state's economy, unfortunately. And we just don't see the situation getting any better. The greatest concern for me as a person with diabetes is on the heart attack side. Unfortunately, people with diabetes run a risk of heart attack that's about four times greater than the rest of the population. So I think we can agree diabetes is going to provide a sizable challenge to the state of Oregon for quite some time. Legislation similar to that before you was recently signed into law in Kentucky and Texas. Each time the legislation passed unanimously out of each chamber, there was no fiscal cost associated with the bill. But in my opinion, Oregon is the model state to implement this bill. Primary reason is you have a data set that exists in this state and a commitment to help your population that I haven't seen in other states. You have the wherewithal, you have the interest, you have the commitment. The only question is, what can you do to help people with diabetes? I believe the bill offers options and opportunities you can seize today to dictate the terms by which you will engage diabetes and not have diabetes dictate the terms to you by which it will engage you. Enacting this legislation is a reasonable first step to take in light of the growing epidemic. I greatly appreciate the time to be here today, the time that you've given me, and I'm available to answer any questions should you have them. And hopefully we got under 10 minutes.
Thanks for bringing this forward. Comments? We've got to move on. Thank you very much.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
I'll close the public hearing on state of diabetes in Oregon and open a public hearing of an update on Early Learning Council. Duke Shepherd and Janet Carlson, please come forward.
Informational.
Informational. Oh, informational. Yes.
Just semantics.
Morning,
good morning,
Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Duke Shepherd, policy advisor to Governor Kitzhaber, and I'm here to give you a brief update on the work of the Early Learning Council, which was created last session in Senate Bill 909 with the task of analyzing plans to merge, redesign, and improve coordination of early learning services for children in Oregon. The larger context here is that in Oregon, about 46,000 babies are born each year. About 40% of them are exposed to or exhibit some level of risk, which creates a cohort of about 108,000 children under the age of five who, with access to services to improve the trajectory of their lives are the people who can become the greatest success in our state or who can continue to have bad outcomes. And what we've seen over the past many years in Oregon is that we are simply not getting it done. The one underlying premise is that we have many silos and many fine efforts and no coordinated system. The discouraging part is that in statute, we have a system. In fact, it is called the Oregon Early Childhood System in statute. And many of the aspirational policy targets that were in Senate Bill 909 are already in statute. That the things that we want to do have been on the state's to-do list for over 10 years. Unfortunately, there has not been a connection to accountability, to the resources, to the budgeting, and to the expectation for outcomes for children. So this is really, while it is an important policy initiative, it is also recognizing that the efforts thus far and the good intentions have not been enough. So the Early Learning Council produced a report recommending a series of next steps. Rather than go through the report, I thought I would highlight for you what will likely be in legislation because the report makes a number of recommendations, but what will be before this body in a few weeks will be a bill that came out of that. And the key recommendations really are this. So at the statewide level, where we have fractured policy and governance without much authority, you have the State Commission on Children and Families right now, you have the Commission for Child Care, and you have the Early Childhood Matters Advisory Council. The proposal is to take those duties, eliminate those committees, and give them to the Early Learning Council so that it is in one single body to provide some direction and accountability across state government. As a note, the Early Childhood Matters Advisory Council was created by Governor Kulongoski under an executive order and is the state advisory council on Head Start, which is required by federal law, and that designation and some changes to membership would occur for the Early Learning Council so that we have one single body doing what that one single body is supposed to do, both under federal law and ideally here at the state. In terms of the delivery system, one important note is that in this first series of recommendations, there are no changes proposed to any direct services. So ideally, I've called this sort of the behind-the-curtain stuff, that the services that are provided directly to children and families, whether it's case management or connecting to resources, the changes we're talking about now should be invisible to them. The goal here is to streamline the administrative structure, put some accountability mechanisms in place, and tee things up for you all to consider bigger changes in 2013 after further work. The big change that would be in the delivery system would be on the local commission system. We have 36 commissions in Oregon, commissions on children and families. The proposal from the Early Learning Council is to, instead of what you have now, which is a formula allocation and an expectation of a report, and that's given directly to counties, to instead focus on outcomes, be explicit about the outcomes and the programs and participations in community that we want to deliver a coordinated system, and do an RFP and encourage and challenge communities to come together to figure out how to deliver those results. The idea being that places where the existing structure works fine for everybody will probably be successful, and there are communities in Oregon that are going to want to do something different. And opening things up to a little competition and encouraging people to challenge themselves and focus on outcomes really for the first time, outcomes that would be determined at the state level, would be an important change to set up. So that proposal will be in the legislation, but again, the funds that would be RFP'd out would be those that are only used for administration right now. There would also be a 15% limit on administrative dollars in this proposal, so the idea here is also that we begin to wring out more direct service dollars, even if they are not enormous dollars, but more direct service dollars to go to more children and more families to provide more service.
Madam Chair, it's a concern here, quite honestly. So what you're saying is that the state is in a better position to determine the priority needs of Douglas County than Douglas County is?
Madam Chair, Senator Cruz, that's certainly not what...
It's what you just said. The state will determine the priorities rather than the priorities be determined at the county level like they currently are.
What I'm trying to say is that you spend state dollars, and right now you expect no outcomes for those state dollars. the proposal here is to expect some outcomes for those state dollars. Now, those outcomes are things like getting children ready for kindergarten, which is actually in statute already, but for which there's not been a cause and effect or an accountability feedback between the dollars spent. I'm talking, these are the larger level outcomes, not you must run your program in this way. What we're trying to conceptually get away from is a system right now that's very focused on dictating structure. You must have this many meetings and this many plans and produce a plan every year and look this way versus here's the outcome we want, go get it. The community should know better how to go get it. So in Douglas County, maybe it's community action, maybe it is the county commission. It really is, who does it is less important than that it gets done.
Okay, and I'll we're meeting Friday afternoon, so I'll save the rest of the questions for that.
Thank you, sir. So, members of the committee, those are the big changes that are proposed. Everything else is really teeing things up for 2013. So in terms of early intervention, early childhood special education, there are no changes proposed whatsoever to those services. It's just a direction to the Early Learning Council to have a joint planning process with the State Interagency Council on early intervention, early childhood special education, because those services are unique and underfunded and an incredibly important part of the system, but how those services fit in needs a lot more work and should involve the folks who know that system best.
What about 3 minutes?
Okay, sorry. And there, I just, for the record, there are no changes proposed to Head Start. And if I could say that very clearly, Head Start is created by the federal government. The changes that are coming to Head Start are coming from the federal government. So there are no changes proposed to the state-funded portions of Head Start. The only hope and expectation is what's already in statute, to be a part of the system and be a part of moving things forward. Thank you.
Thank you. Janet.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Janet Carlson, Marion County Commissioner, immediate past president of the Association of Oregon Counties and co-chair of the AOC Early Learning Task Force that met last fall. I have provided to you in your offices, except for Senator Shields, which I didn't get that far yesterday, so I provided it here, a full copy of our report. It's also on the web. I also provided here for everyone an executive summary. We had a vast array of people that worked together last fall to respond to and look at what was going on at the time at the design team at the state level, and we've been following it closely. Our recommendations, 25 recommendations, are around target population, outcomes, program and system design, and governance. And this is really AOC's position embedded in this document. It was approved by our legislative committee in October. I want to make four quick points. The first one is that AOC supports the governor's vision and goals for early learning, and I want to thank Duke Shepherd for his responsiveness. We've been working very closely together. He's been very open to suggestions and ideas and has shared some concepts, and we do appreciate that. I provided for you a PowerPoint slide that I used when I presented to the Early Learning Task Force that made it into the 909 report that kind of shows how the money crisscrosses as it flows and some of the systemic problems that we have in terms of trying to get our arms around how to get all of these providers and programs to work in tandem. In 1993, when the commission legislation was passed, actually the language was very strong. It said the boards of county commissioners would oversee an entire system for children and families. There was a lot of pushback. In 1999, the bill was revised, Senate Bill 555, you probably remember that, and the county role became to convene and facilitate, and it has really been through our, I call it our scintillating personalities and the goodwill of the people that we work with, that we've been able to make progress in terms of joint planning. But I agree with Duke, it hasn't gone to the full extent where programs are cleanly aligned, and if there are providers or programs in a community that don't want to play nice in the sandbox, for want of a more technical term, there is no real teeth in the legislation that allows a county or a local community to bring that person. There's no hammer, there's only carrots, I guess is the best way to describe that. In this report, we are, and with the governor's office, we are working to determine what the county role will be in the new system. I provided for you a couple illustrations that are in the report, and things have evolved since we did the report, so some of the language is where it was in October. But if you look at the governance model, we see the counties, actually county elected officials, involved in the accountability hub, both perhaps in a governance level, because there will be values and policy choices made in terms of purchasing services. Also, we're involved at a service delivery level. We provide juvenile services, community corrections, the services that are now provided by Children and Families, health and mental health, to name a few. And so we're providing in that box. But I think the piece that we still have to figure out is if there's an accountability hub, which I strongly believe in, where all the dollars align and performance-based contracts to make sure people are beholden to outcomes, the piece that I think we still need to work on together is the implementation on the ground and how do all of these things work across. We have Children and Families Commissions now that have convened networking groups of providers, have helped bring people together, write common grants, share ideas, that kind of thing. I think that there's a need for that function. It could be fulfilled by an accountability hub, but I think the details really aren't worked out about how that might happen. So I've heard from people recently, particularly in the rural areas, that the commissions form important access points for services that people are concerned about losing. In Washington County, which is not a small county, they provide family resource centers connected to schools. These may very well be important in a new early learning system. And then there is a recommendation in the 909 report that there be a youth development council, and that's something that the legislature will deliberate on, that would look at the 6 to 18 or wherever the early learning ends to that. So we're actually advocating for the local commission sunset to not be until July 1, 2013, in order that there be a transition to dovetail both with this youth development proposal and to make sure that the hubs are up and running so we don't have a gap in terms of what's being provided locally. The last point that I would make is that I think there are important ties to healthcare transformation in early learning, and I often say that it's 6 months kind of behind healthcare transformation. Senator Bates pointed out the overlap in population that we're serving. Initially, there were 5 regional hubs that were going to be for healthcare transformation and 5 hubs in the early learning transition team report. As healthcare transformation has evolved to coordinated care organizations, I think we're going to have to see how this accountability hub model connects, if you will, with the coordinated care organization model. Both initiatives talk about a global budget. I do think that early learning has some fundamental differences from healthcare, and so the idea of global budget when you have classroom services, family daycare providers, any number of other, you know, in-home visit services and those things don't lend itself quite as cleanly to the idea of a capitated model as perhaps it does in healthcare transformation. But we are committed as counties to continue working with you and with the governor's office to help figure this out for the best interest of our young children and their families in Oregon.
Thank you. I'm sorry we don't have a lot of time to discuss because we have to go to our last topic.
I just very briefly, I'd say I finally got Dr. Goldberg yesterday in reference to global budget to say we're talking in healthcare about a global Medicaid budget, which I thought was an improvement.
Thank you very much for the update. Things are moving fast, and I'm glad we had the opportunity to have your presentation. With that, I'll close the informational hearing on Early Learning Council and open our final presentation from the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families Alliance, Rachel Post, Stacy Michelson, and Patty Whitney Wise. Okay, thank you. Please sit down and introduce yourself. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to testify in front of you today. My name is Rachel Post. I'm a policy advisor for Central City Concern in Portland, and I'm here today to talk with you about Temporary Assistance for Needy Families, or the TANF program. TANF provides families and children with basic assistance to help them make ends meet while they get back on their feet. And today I've also provided you with a couple of documents. One identifies the program in Central City Concern I'll talk about in terms of the impact that the cuts to the jobs program has had on our families who are in recovery from addiction treatment. The other is a feature story on Selena Perez, who will be testifying after me, who is a former graduate of our program. At Central City Concern in Portland, we provide comprehensive solutions to ending homelessness and achieving self-sufficiency through our continuum of affordable housing options integrated with direct social services, including housing, healthcare, recovery, and employment programming. During the 2011 legislative session, many programs and services that make up our safety net experienced serious cuts. The TANF program experienced very severe cuts on a wide range of fronts, as you'll hear from the TANF Alliance representative, Stacy. These cuts have negative effects for families receiving basic services, and I'm here today to talk with you about one particular cut of the many to this program and its impact on the families that we serve at Central City Concern. One of the many cuts to the Department of Human Services budget was the jobs program, a part of TANF. The cuts made in the 2011 legislative session mean that families entering or exiting drug or alcohol treatment now have no access to child care or transportation services to help them attend treatment or seek work once they've completed treatment. For families working to rebuild their lives after receiving treatment for an addiction, these budget cuts are devastating. Residential and outpatient treatment for parents is a critical service for helping parents get back on their feet and being reunited with their children from the foster care system. Currently, funding for this critical service comes from a variety of sources, and child care is an important piece of the puzzle. For every $1 the legislature spends on child care, Central City Concern leverages $2.50 in supportive care services that help reunify and stabilize families. These leveraged dollars come from Health and Human Services, Housing and Urban Development, state, county, and city general funds. Child care is a critical building block for family success, and the lack of child care that resulted from the cuts made in 2011 is proving devastating to families. While some funds have been identified to help families who were receiving treatment when child care supports were ended, many more parents are unable to attend treatment for an addiction or are unable to look for work after completing treatment, therefore being unable to exit the TANF rolls. Without child care, children and adults face overwhelming obstacles to making positive changes in their lives. Without positive change, they could and will be forced to access other more costly services such as foster care, healthcare system, and homeless shelters. For example, our program...
We have about 3 minutes if you want Stacy to go, because we have another committee.
Okay, I'll pass this along to Selena Perez. She'll speak quickly, and so Stacy can go.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I want to thank you for your time right now and letting me speak. My name is Selena Perez, and before I went into Luddy Owings, I was really strung out on drugs, criminal activity. I had this little baby. I called Luddy Owings and got into the treatment program. They helped me get connected with TANF and child care services so I can get the help and all the classes and the parenting skills that I have today. When I got out of Luddy Owings, I went into housing. They helped me. My son was able to go to the child care so I can get my outpatient, which I needed for more support and more tools to stay clean and sober. When I completed all that and graduated, the state TANF helped paid for daycare so I can look for a job. I quickly got a job. I've been working for 2 years. I'm getting unemployment related daycare assistance right now that helps me so I can go to work every day. I just want to thank you so much and let you guys know that this has saved my life. It has saved my son's life. My son is with me, and thank you very much. This is really important. I am really nervous, and I'm sorry.
Oh, you're doing great. It takes a lot of courage to tell your story to all these people up here, and truly it's so meaningful.
Thank you so much for your guys' time.
Thanks, Chair Mona Sanderson, members of the committee. I'm happy to sacrifice a little bit of time because I think the personal stories that you hear from those who actually access these services speak volumes far more than I can.
Say your name.
Oh, sorry, for the record, Stacy Michelson, Policy Associate with Children First for Oregon, representing the Oregon TANF Alliance today. So again, I think the personal stories really speak to the importance of these programs, but I just wanted to give you a really quick overview of our perspective as the TANF Alliance and some of our priorities. We worked closely with many of you and your colleagues on the Ways and Means Committee in 2011, looking at some of the budget priorities within human services. And while we understand why a lot of the cuts were made, I think having a little bit of hindsight, now that a lot of those budget alterations have gone into effect, we've been able to see some of the impacts that those have had on the families that you've heard from. And we'd like to provide a little bit of feedback and some suggestions moving forward. You each have a fact sheet in front of you, or you should, with our specific recommendations. So I'll just provide a really high-level overview that specifically we're really concerned with the elimination of post-TANF payments, reduction in pre-SSI, SSDI enhanced grants for families, the continued low-level cap and current freeze on employment-related daycare, which we just heard is really important, and the cuts to jobs clients that help provide transportation and child care services so they can actually access those services. I think we all agree that or understand that TANF exists as a last resort safety net program for families, and none of us wants to see families on TANF any longer than necessary. So we believe that a few small investments in some key areas could actually help families transition off of TANF much more quickly and have a higher success rate of actually achieving self-sufficiency without falling back onto the program. So for those reasons, we'd recommend looking at a reinstatement of post-TANF for a year, ensuring that no family experiences more than a $100 reduction in their enhanced grants, raising the employment-related daycare cap back to 2010 levels, and restoring some services for jobs clients. Again, you have the fact sheet in front of you. I will say, minimum, some of those suggestions would cost $330,000 is what we've penciled out on our cocktail napkins, and at most there's some pots of funding that we think exist for some of those other services. And I know that any member of the TANF Alliance is happy to talk to you individually about where
some
of those funds
might come from. Well, this is a Ways and Means issue, and
come from, so.
Senator Bates is here, and I want to thank you very much for testifying.
Yeah, I appreciate your time, and any questions, we're always happy to answer.
For you. Yes, I'd like to close the informational hearing on TANF. And colleagues, just to remind you, we have a meeting Friday on transformation. As you know, we just didn't have time to include that. So 1:15 in hearing room B, it'll be 1:15 to 3:15. And it's really important to have you here. I know Senator Bates has to be on the phone, correct? You're not going to be here. You'll be on the phone for Friday. Yeah, yeah.
And I'll leave at 3.
Yeah.
Yeah. That works.
That's great. All right. With that, thank you, everyone, and we're adjourned.